Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Monday, April 15th, 2019, Dover Beach City Council meeting. So with that, we'll do a call to order, and if you all please rise and just pause for a moment of silence for the significance of the fire at Notre Dame and to pray for the men and women who are fighting that fire. Thank you for that moment of silence. And now, if we would, we'll have Carissa Moreno lead us in our flag salute this evening. So, Carissa, thank you for joining us. She is 9 years old and is in third grade at a Fairgrove Elementary School. So Carissa enjoys math and writing, and what she enjoys most about living on the Central Coast are the weather and the nice people who live here. Thank you for that. So she tells us that she would like to be an engineer when she grows up. Great profession. So outside of school, she enjoys art, playing basketball, and video games. She's joined this evening by her mom, Holly, and her sister, Lexi. So, Mom, feel free to take pictures. So Carissa, if you would, please. Nicely done. So, if you would, we've got some... Thank you, Carissa, for leading us in the flag salute. And if you would, City Clerk, roll call, please.
Councilmember Bright.
Here.
Councilmember Lance.
Yes.
Councilmember Nichols is absent. Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Here.
And Mayor Lee.
I am here as well. So we have a quorum, which then leads us into our closed session announcements, please. City Attorney. Thank you for those closed session announcements. That'll take us into agenda review, where at this time the council may review the order of business to be conducted and receive requests, if anyone has, to change the order of the day. Does anyone have any requests to do that? If not, I'll accept a motion to proceed as published. This is where you listen to me and you say...
I'll make a motion. I'll make that motion.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We will proceed as published. So with that, we will move into public communications, where I do have a number of speaker slips this evening. So we'll recall everyone to remember that we are all neighbors in the community. We are here to listen. As the fact that there is not an item on the agenda this evening that you may be speaking on, we are not able to take action on those items. This is a time where any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. The council will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, the council cannot act at items not on the agenda. Mm. So in realizing that, again, we may have diverse opinions this evening, if you do agree with the speaker, please no verbal clapping or anything of that, but jazz hands are always appreciated. So either way. So with that, we'll proceed with...
Mr. Mayor?
Certainly.
Do you have a ceremonial presentation?
I do apologize. I've gone into public communications early. Thank you, sir. We do have a ceremonial calendar. I apologize for our members of the public. So going backwards into our our ceremonial calendar. So if you would, Councilmember Lance, if you would read our proclamation this evening. Thank you, sir.
Proclamation of the City Council of the City of Grover Beach declaring April 26th, 2019 as National Arbor Day. Whereas... In 1872, J. Sterling Morton proposed to the Nebraska Board of Agriculture that a special day be set aside for the planting of trees. And whereas this special day, the last Friday in April, called National Arbor Day, was first observed with the planting of more than 1 million trees in Nebraska. And whereas Arbor Day is observed throughout the nation and the world. And whereas trees can reduce the erosion of our precious topsoil from wind and water, cut heating and cooling costs, moderate the temperature, clean the air, produce oxygen, and provide habitat for wildlife. And whereas trees are a renewable resource, giving us paper, wood for our homes, fuel for our fires, and countless other wood products. And whereas trees in our city increase property values, enhance the economic vitality of business areas, and beautify our community. And whereas Grover Beach desires to continue its tree planting exercises. And whereas the Grover Beach Parks and Recreation Department will conduct an Arbor Day ceremony and children's special event on Friday, April 26, 2019, at 16th Street Park from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. to plant 8 trees, provide children's activities, and celebrate the importance of trees. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the City Council of the City of Grover Beach does hereby officially proclaim April 26, 2019 as National Arbor Day in Grover Beach and urges all citizens to support efforts to care for our trees and woodlands and to support our community tree program.
Thank you very much for that. So I understand, Ms. Petker, you're here to receive the proclamation on behalf of the City and Parks and Recreation. Okay, Ms. Petker, I understand you have a couple comments you'd like to share with us.
Just a couple quick comments. Thank you, Honorable Mayor, Council members. Again, we are very happy to be able to celebrate Arbor Day. We will be having an event on Friday, April 26th from 3 to 5 p.m. at 16th Street Park. We have lots of activities planned. It's open to the public. Please come out. We are going to have representatives from our partners of the San Luis Obispo County YMCA, the Five Cities Fire Authority, Cal Poly Logging Team, the California State Parks, and Master Gardeners. So we'll have lots of stations for the kids to participate in. We'll have obstacle course and relay games and lots of fun to celebrate trees. We're going to have 8 trees, and we are very happy to be able to replant a lot of the trees. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And so that was Ramona Park.
16th Street.
16th Street Park at 3 p.m.
3 p.m.
on April 26th.
Yes.
Great. We'll look forward to having a nice turnout there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So after that brief respite into the remembrance of trees and Arbor Day, now we will move into public communications, where any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. Again, I do have a number of speaker slips, so please remember our code of civility, which is on the back of our chambers, and I look forward to us listening to each of your comments. So with that, we'll start with Ted Alclan, please. And that'll be followed by Catherine Sells.
Good evening, City Council. Okay, thanks a lot for allowing me to speak my opposition to the Hillside Project. My name is Theodore Aklan. I've been a resident of Arroyo Grande for almost 30 years. I've been a property owner at 1343 Grand Avenue. Grover Beach. The reason it's not exactly that I totally opposed it, but the issue is the location that you pick, and it's going to add additional traffic that would increase the safety of the children passing by there almost every day to go to school. And also the senior people that like use that as part of their pathway when they go doing their daily walk. And my wife is another testament to that one. To alleviate the fear of the children and the senior citizen that's going to be walking there, there's no discussions on talking about all the presentation I have heard, not now mentioned on how they're going to protect the children and the senior, that as a result of the increased traffic that this project is being considered. So I'm asking you to please cooperate and put your heads together, including the staff, talk it over and make a decision and make sure that whoever, when you put it on a contract and you authorize it, there is a certain stipulation how you're going to protect the children. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Catherine Sells, followed by Tom Girard.
Hi, I'm Catherine Sells. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm in favor of the project. I've lived in Grover Beach for 27 years. I don't live in that particular neighborhood, but I have worked with the homeless in my capacity at social services, from which I retired 5 years ago. But I can't imagine that there exists any location in the Five Cities area that would suit both the needs of the homeless population and at the same time would satisfy the criteria of the HEAP grant that would not be challenged with the same doubts and fears that are being expressed by the Neighbors for Safety group. But the problem is this. The homeless population is not getting smaller. It is increasing. If we don't accept that and do something now, we're all going to see homeless persons on our streets, in our yards, everywhere we go. We can't just wait for that non-existent ideal location that pleases everyone and think that we can live in the status quo. There is no status quo, not in the world we live in today. Today's world is in a constant state of change, and we have to be able to adapt to it. We have to accept that the places where we live are constantly changing, and unless we can adapt to those changes, we're going to suffer and worry needlessly. We need this project, and we need it now. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Tom Girard, followed by William Ashley.
Good evening. I appreciate you giving me the time to speak. I was here last week, and I spoke about my concerns as far as the safety for the children. I had issues on Grand Avenue with my building, and I had issues with the homeless, and it became a violent situation. We ended up moving my office. So, you know, I was looking when you guys sent out notices to the nearby neighbors, you went 300 feet. So that seems to be the thing, 300 feet from wherever the center is going to be. So I thought about that. I said, well, let's go 300 feet away from Five Cities Homeless Coalition, and let's see what happens. So I picked a random year, went to the police department, and they said there was 895 service calls to Vons 1 year. That's a lot. And you're going to move the Five Cities Homeless Coalition into this residential neighborhood. There's going to be a lot of action over there that they're not equipped to deal with. And we're going to put kids in harm's way. We're going to put seniors in harm's way. It's a bad situation. I think everyone wants to help the homeless, and there is a better location on Fort Street. And I don't know if the city council has taken the time to go look at that. I was there on Friday. I did look at the building. There's a lot of miscommunication out there saying that the building's in bad shape, it's falling down. Nothing could be further from the truth. So they could have that building up and running within 30 days. You could be actually helping people if that's really the goal here. The building is huge. It's over 21,000 square feet. You could have a warming center. You could have all the things that you want there. The other thing about that is that it's right around work. So you could, if it's truly a transitional thing for the homeless and you want the homeless to actually get up on their feet and have a home, there's all kinds of jobs around there. You have the outlets. You have laundry facilities, hotels, so on and so forth. So that's the right location, and you don't have all of the issues that are going to happen to this neighborhood if you put it in the wrong location. So I'm asking you guys to actually take the time, go look at that building. It's available. It's the same money. The Homeless Coalition is saying that they're going to take out the warming center at the Hillside location to appease the neighbors. They could have it at this location. They could have everything they want, and it's the right location. So I ask you guys to take the time. Research the other location. Don't just dismiss it and say, oh, no, we have one, and it's all good, because it's not all good. So anyway, thank you.
Next up is William Ashley, followed by Robert Downey.
Hi, I'm William Ashley. I've been helping tabulate the signatures for the people that are concerned about the Five City Homeless Coalition proposing to transfer their offices into our neighborhood. That's a large commercial enterprise and should be in a commercial area. We hope that you will not zone that, rezone it from R1 to commercial. It will impact our neighborhood. We're also concerned about the proposal to put up to 44 young men with supervisors in a very small space. It's just the first floor of that kind of additional building there. That proposed dorm, I think, really would not be good. There's little space separate from the 1 acre they will take for activities. Maybe they'll put it up the hill, but it really is a bad confined situation for that. Also, I've got a question. I sent an update to many of you. I hope you were able to see it with the number of counts. We're up to 520 people that are concerned about this. And I brought numbers before and copies of signatures and gave it to Matthew Brunson. But when I look at the minutes, I don't see any note of what anybody said as far as whether they are for or against this project. I don't see that the signatures were even acknowledged. So does that stuff not get in your minutes? We just come up here and you go, yeah, Bill spoke and John spoke, and but you don't tabulate what we say, what we're for and what we're against?
Go ahead and finish your comments. So,
well, that's a question. It seems weird to me that we all say things and you don't put down on paper that you had, you know, one meeting, 100 people showed up that were concerned about it and eight were in favor of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Robert Downey, followed by John Weissong. So.
Grover Beach, December 16th. 6 to 12 p.m., light rain. Grover Beach, December 17th, low temperature in the morning, 54 degrees. Grover Beach Police Department, CFS event details, arrival time, 9:54 a.m. San Luis County Sheriff's Office, incident report, arrival time, 10:07 a.m. What happened there? Homeless woman, 58 years old, found unresponsive, pronounced dead, at the Rabobank drive-up teller lane, 9th Street and Grand. So why am I talking about this? You'll find out. This is a response from an email from a high-up city official in Grover Beach to a response to an email from a resident. We had a woman this winter that was dropped off by the police at the warming center and chose not to attend the warming center. She died that night at Rabobank parking lot. Okay, so Rooster Creek, March 4th, Five Cities Homeless Coalition event. One of the speakers there said a homeless woman died because she did not know the warming center was open. That was just debunked. On April 9th, AG City Council meeting, the same thing was said. Yesterday, April 14th, over at the park, over here, the same thing was also said. Now, on March 6th, the Cortland Section 8 housing project, one of the Five Cities Homeless Coalition said, one of our own died on the street because there was not enough homeless services. Well, I agree with that. Now, if the HEAP funding, Group A and Group B, was done, there'd be lots of money given to projects that would help drug, alcohol addiction, and mental health. Okay, so let's go on. This is the San Luis Obispo County's Sheriff's Office coroner's final autopsy report. I won't read anything gross. Description of the clothing. The body is clad in a black leather jacket, black and white hoodie, black jeans, socks, slip-on shoes. The scene is wrapped in a blanket. Possessions. There's also marijuana smoking pipe and an empty pint bottle of vodka. Coroner's made a statement that the decedent has been homeless off and on for the previous 10 to 12 years. Cause of death. The cause of death is determined to be complications from chronic alcoholism. So the Five Cities Homeless Coalition people keep trying to make this woman's death a responsibility that it wasn't. It was because there's no warming center. No, she died because she was an alcoholic. Tragically, she had no services. There's not enough services in this county, and I wish that Five Cities Homeless Coalition will stop lying about how she died and use.
Thank you for your comments.
Use this Thank against
you.
It.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Weissong, followed by Les Henderson.
I got a couple articles here about taxes in dysfunctional California. Also, I came here in 1957. I can't do my math. But there was 900 and some people here. I know how to run a business. I worked at Safeway 37 years. I'm a Korean vet, and I've been in the business for over 55 years, and agriculture here in the Midwest for 60 years. I know the government. I know how it works, and I had people, or came with people in the 1960s and 70s, and we came before the planning and city council and tried to tell them how to plan this town. But that's when the swamp came in the 80s. And now those 20 people are gone. She's gone. And we don't have but renters and people don't speak English. It's sad. But so constructive criticism never hurt anybody. It's a damn truth that hurts. And the truth is that Grover Beach is going downhill because that place up there where the church is and they want the people. I understand what they're doing. I've listened to everybody. But they want to build houses up there. 101 out there has been here since 1955. And the only thing that's changed is three lanes over there at Spyglass. So, Alex Madonna built that. And we don't have people in this California that know how to manage. Because I've gone across the country 25 times since 1960, and every time I go, they're building roads. They're making highways. And those people out there aren't rich. They're poor. They don't make the money you do. They don't have $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 houses like you do. They have $20,000, $30,000, $50,000. And the fact is that they want to build houses up there. So what you need to do is first things come first. Take care of your water because that's healthy. Take care of the highways because that's where people go. Bumper to bumper, both ways. Morning and night. So you don't build houses, and St. Louis and you are just, that's all you can know, is build houses. Well, where are the people going to go? How are they going to go? Bicycles? But it's time for you people to do first things first and do it right and take care.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments tonight, John. Thank you, sir. Next up, we have Mr. Les Henderson, followed by Diane Shannon.
Good evening, folks. My name is Les Henderson. I live in Grover Beach. I'm here to talk about the Hillside Project. What bothers me the most, and I've been doing a lot of talking with people, is I've talked to the county supervisors. I've talked to Pismo Beach, City Council. I've talked to Roy Grandy, City Council. And everybody that I talk to with regards to this project implies to me that it's a done deal. And I truly believe that. I think this was started back in 2018. I truly believe decisions were made that all of you will be either pressured to vote for this, but I truly believe that it's a done deal. All these cities are for this. This is a done deal. The sad thing is you left out us, the people, the residents, the people that pay taxes, pay the bills. You forgot about us. And for that, it's a sad thing. I ask you shortly to go to the library and read books about the blighted areas, how they start, what happens. Very interesting. The last comment I'd like to make is I was at the meeting yesterday with self-help group and also the homeless coalition. And what I noticed when I got to Ramona Park about 2:45, beautiful day, sun out, gorgeous day, no wind. There wasn't a single family, a single young person, a child, on that park. What there was 10 homeless people. That's sad to see that happen. So I know it's a done deal, folks, but you're putting us in a corner. And when somebody puts us in a corner, I think we've got enough support out here that we're just not going to stand by and let you overlook the people that love the city, have been here a long time, and are trying to keep our homes and our neighborhoods in a good position. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Mr. Henderson. Next up is Diane Shannon, followed by Susie Reed.
Hello. My name is Diane Shannon. I live in Grover Beach. I oppose the Hillside Project for several common sense reasons. As a mother, a grandmother, and as well as a retired educator working with at-risk high school age students, I'm very concerned for all the children that walk to and from Ocean View and Grover Heights Elementary every day, including my grandson. They are being exposed to the current problem of drugs, alcohol bottles, hypodermic needles, etc. Parents do not feel safe letting their children play outside or ride their bikes. These are neighborhood activities children should have a right to do. Common sense. Neighborhood families who have lived in the community 10 to 60 years have seen negative changes since opening the warming center. Strangers lurking on their property, refusing to leave, police being called to have the intruder taken away just to be returned in 15 minutes. Cars broken into, bikes stolen, men with their pants down, yelling at people in the neighborhood. Well, you get the idea. I could go on. Also, the elderly are extremely vulnerable. My neighbor is 83 years old, had her car broken into for the change that was in the console. She lives alone. She struggles to get by. She votes. She pays taxes. And she contributes to our community. Where's her help? How much do you really care about her? She has the right to feel safe, as we all do in our community. Common sense. At this point, how is this project helping the homeless? You removed the warming center. Now it's being referred to as a transitional youth housing. Neighbors, these are housing units for 19 to 24-year-olds. They're using the word youth, but we all know that these are mostly men getting paroled from prison, transitioning into our residential neighborhood. Are you serious? There will be up to 44 parolees out in our streets and our neighborhoods that are expected to be out during the day looking for community work or a job. Really? According to Jana from People's Self-Help Housing, their curfew is 10 p.m. There will be only one caseworker monitoring these men. This is a small, sleepy community that rolls up the streets about 8:30. Well, it's not if something happens, it's when. I pray it's not a child that is the first victim. And if so, who will take responsibility? You? This is an R1 neighborhood and would need to be rezoned. We will continue to fight there as well. Please work with us. There's a better location. Several alternative locations have been suggested to City Council, 5 City Homeless, People Self-Help. Unfortunately, because of the lack of communication early on by your part.
Thank you for those comments, Ms. Shannon. We do have a number of people.
We feel it's a done deal.
We thank you for those comments. And you'll notice that I am keeping people directly to your 3 minutes this evening. I do have a number of speaker slips still to go. So thank you for respecting the three-minute time limit this evening. You are being heard. So Ms. Susie Reed, followed by Paul Reinhardt.
Hi, I'm Susie Reed. I live in Grover Beach. We attended the community meeting yesterday that was sponsored by People's Self-Help and 5 Cities Homeless. And I've come up with two major concerns, among many, but let's go to. At the beginning of the meeting, when the individuals were introducing themselves in the project, the implication or the impression that the crowd got was that this is a done deal, including the zoning, which is very concerning, despite the fact that there has been no public meeting to discuss any zoning changes. But it was implied that zoning was part of the approval process for the HEAP funds, and no problemo. The second, as the afternoon progressed, the scope of the clientele that was being described kept changing. We went from drug addicts, and I'm talking about transitional housing, from drug addicts to the homeless incarcerated, to troubled youth, then to women with babies. To borrow from Forrest Gump, this project is like a box of chocolates. We don't know what we're going to get. From everything we have seen and heard, there is still nothing that we as a neighborhood can support. We urge you to again consider your constituents as you review this concept project. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. And before I bring up Mr. Paul Reinhardt, if you do have a cell phone that's either on buzz or on speed dial or something of that nature, please silence those if you would, please, so that people can make sure that their comments are heard. So Mr. Paul Reinhardt, followed by Paul Hertel, please.
Hello, council members. Thank you for the time. I'm here to revoice my objection to the proposed Hillside Church Homeless Center being recommended for HEAP funding. After attending the recent neighborhood outreach efforts and reviewing the proposed project changes, including their HEAP application amendment letter dated April 10th, indicating their intent to omit the warming center, this proposed mega one-stop shop homeless center located in an established existing single-family residential neighborhood brings many incompatibilities and is unprecedented. The project requires a general plan amendment and a spot zoning change. Spot zoning is just bad planning. The project has been poorly planned and is in the wrong location. There are many other projects that have been applied for HEAP funding that will serve the South County and are ready to go without community opposition. Please consider efforts to withdraw your previously issued HEAP funding support letter for the Hillside Church Center to allow these other viable county homeless emergency aid projects to move forward. Thank you. Can I leave this letter with?
Yes, please. I'll leave it with the city manager. If you have a letter for the Board of Supervisors, please direct it to them directly.
So communication here does not go to the board?
We are separate entities, so it does not automatically go. No, correct. But thank you. So next up, Mr. Paul Hertel, followed by Bob Westrom.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff. I'm going to read you a letter that I sent to Mr. John Fowler this morning at 5:45 a.m., but I'd like to preface that with John Fowler has reached out to our campaign. He and I correspond by text, telephone calls, emails, communication, and he's looking for a solution. And he was up at our house with Jana on Saturday with our core group of campaign members, and we were trying to find that solution. We spent about 2 hours at my house on Hillcrest Drive in Rio Grande. There was no concession on either side, either from John and Jana or from our group. It didn't feel like we were going anywhere, so the meeting was adjourned, and we moved on. So I did attend the meeting yesterday at Ramona Park, and it was well attended with a lot of opposition to the project. So this is a letter I'm going to read to John after he texted me after that meeting and was reaching out to me. John, thanks for texting yesterday evening. At the Ramona meeting yesterday, PS, People's Self-Help Housing, and Five Cities Homeless Coalition really saw how upset residents are that we are losing what is a beautiful, quiet neighborhood. You can be assured that the group you met with at my house feel the same way. Our residents lost trust in both organizations a while ago, and it will never be regained. Our campaign continues to grow. Our narrative hasn't changed, and we are steadfast in keeping our neighborhood the way it is. Most stakeholders in favor of this proposal are transient. They are either termed out, leave office, retire, or move on to another job. Most of our residents have lived here for a long time. We built our house 25 years ago and intend on staying here forever. Is it right to make a decision that will destroy our neighborhood and then move on? A lot of our residents were at the April 3rd HESOC meeting and witnessed what considered was a done deal before the meeting was held. How is it that a nonpartisan subcommittee of HESOC can recommend options A, B, and C, which spread money around to almost all applicants in an equitable well, only to have a new option D recommended and motioned to be the best option? Requirements for funding were mostly based on readiness and financial risk. People's Self-Help Housing and Five Cities Homeless Coalition were near the bottom of the list. We feel the right thing to do, and I think I can speak for most of our campaign, would be for People's Self-Help Housing, Five Cities, to decline option D or ask the Board of Supervisors to delay the funding until the right proposal is brought forth that has community support for right idea, right location. Delayed decisions are commonly done by planning commissioners, city councils, and Board of Supervisors. Finally, you and Jana have been to our neighborhood and my house, and I'm not sure where you live, but development of Hillside will forever change this neighborhood. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Bob Westrom, followed by Becky Moskofian. Did I say that correctly?
Good evening, council members. Thank you for letting me speak tonight. I live at 1859 Newport Avenue, which is within 300 feet of the proposed Navigation Homeless Center. I'm just voicing my opposition to it for several reasons. We've had issues with strangers coming through our planned development unit, and several years ago we actually erected a masonry wall on Oak Park Boulevard, which then stopped that egress through that area. We've also had individuals that looks like sleeping in our bushes with clothing left there and flattened bushes. You know, we feel for those individuals that are looking for a place just to lay their head down and get their rest. But I also have a strong feeling that this project will ruin the whole flavor of this neighborhood. The bigger issue I have is that the individuals running this project seem to vacillate on scope and details such that I don't believe it's ready for funding. And I think there are much better projects out there with the HEAP funding that could be implemented immediately versus a project that we have this great opposition to and is not developed fully so that the neighbors can really truly understand what's going on. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next up is Becky Moskofian, followed by Bruce Severance, please.
Put that way down there. Thank you. Good evening, Mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, and council members. The part of the Hillside Project that may sound benign is actually one of my biggest concerns and the reason why I've put about 200 hours into researching, speaking at public meetings, writing letters, and informing my friends and so forth on social media. Even though I don't live in the neighborhood. 5CHC will move their administrative offices from Grand Avenue into this residential neighborhood along the walking path to Ocean View Elementary, which is less than half a mile, and it requires rezoning from R1 to neighborhood commercial. The intent of neighborhood commercial zone is to provide centers for convenient shopping in residential neighborhoods planned and controlled to the extent that any such center will perform a vital service to the neighborhood in which it is located. That zoning doesn't ring true with this project. 5CHC has a variety of clients. The majority, of course, are there for much-needed help. They have walk-ins coming in for bus passes, food stamps, donations, and they conduct intake for case management services and hold appointments. But what I witnessed at the office on Friday when I was there was Devin, their intake coordinator, getting yelled at and harassed by three men because they were out of food for the day and she was sworn at. It was upsetting to me and my 10-year-old son, who were there to drop off donations from Ocean View Elementary's recent fundraiser. Prospective clients walking into the neighborhood looking for services without these appointments won't be screened as registered sex offenders or other high-risk individuals, such as those that are debilitatingly mentally ill, until they complete intake at the office. I know they will address security on site, but once these clients leave the property or prospective clients leave the property or ask to leave, they're in our residential neighborhood. If this proposal is approved on Tuesday by the Board of Supervisors, please weigh the pros and cons of rezoning this neighborhood. Once it is rezoned, it'll always be commercial, even if the nonprofit relocates. I believe there's a way to provide much-needed affordable and transitional housing, but please keep the administrative offices in a commercial area where they belong. Please do not rezone Newport Avenue. Thank you so much.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Bruce Severance, followed by Chris Barrett, please.
I was here primarily to comment on community choice aggregation. Will I have an opportunity to do that later as well?
Yes, you shall.
Okay. I live on 12th Street and am probably 6 or 7 blocks away from the proposed homeless shelter. I do not oppose it. I feel that we need to put a homeless shelter somewhere in the Five Cities area, and I think we can say forever, not in my backyard. And the reality is these are people who are part of our community, and some of them bring problems with them. And they are much. We are safer as a community if they're under the supervision and guidance of trained professionals. And I feel like I am a safer citizen if the homeless are not sleeping in the bushes in front of my house. And I have homeless people walking up down my street all the time. I see the same faces over and over again. it's also really important to keep in mind what the statistics of homelessness are. 54% of them are homeless because they can't afford their prescription drugs. 35% are youth under 21 in South County. 50% are youth under 21 in North County. About 20% are women fleeing domestic violence. So it's, and only about 19% if I recall, are have a drug addiction or alcohol addiction problem. And those people, I believe, really do need special services. And perhaps the compromise would be to not have those services on this campus and to really keep it strictly for the majority of the family and the youth that really need these services and that the community would be more comfortable with. I would like to engage those who are concerned here to realize that these are probably kids that need their help. These are kids that need mentoring from good parents in the neighborhood. If you're worried about who these kids are, be part of the program and assist in supporting the service in a way that you know that they have the mentoring that they need. I do feel that it's probably too late for the grant to change locations completely, but perhaps we can morph this into something that makes the community feel safer about how it's guided and have alcohol or drug treatment be in a distinctly different location. You know, maybe there's a way to address those issues. And I think it's appropriate to not have sex offenders at that facility given proximity to children and schools. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Chris Barrett, followed by Sylvia Dodd, please.
Hello, my name is Chris Barrett. I speak in opposition to the Hillside Project. It's a totally inappropriate location for that kind of services. I ask you to please follow the city general plan and locate these services in the overlay zone. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Sylvia Dodd, followed by Debbie Peralt. And Ms. Peralt is my last speaker slip, so if you do want to speak, please fill out a blue speaker slip and hand it to the police chief. So, Ms. Dodd.
Good evening, Mayor Pro Tem, and City Council members. I've been listening to a lot of comments and doing some research. Yesterday, I went to the meeting at Ramona. People Self-Help has done some things in Grover with housing in different areas, but they built houses down Oceano and in Grover. That was excellent, but that was a different criteria. The other thing is ECO. That's an excellent program for mothers and babies, but look at the spaces between how big it is and the buffer area they have. It's not so close to the next resident. The other thing I saw, one of your former politicians, I'll say that because I don't want to use names, he helped change the train station where we had an enormous problem with vagrant people, homeless people, cleaned it up, took the trees down, and made the end of Grand more viable and grew the train station. But they moved those people out. If they go to the area that's shown up there, and I'm not going to be directly that involved with it, but I don't want some area to start going back, just like Grover had down before the train station, because now they're going to be welcoming the homeless. Both People Self-Help, I'm going to say this, I support them. I donate to them. I think they're a great group. They do amazing for the ECO. They do the Prada Center. They waited to the RTA building. They looked 5 years for that spot. They had people around them that were industrial kind of not want them, but then that changed. I'm asking that you take a look to what you're doing to one part of our city. Is it going to transition to like the train station was before, because it's so close, so tiny, that there's no room around it that to be visible to see or to take care of it. All I'm asking is take time, see if you can relocate it out of a residential area. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dodd. Next up is Debbie Peralt, followed by Kevin Watkins, please.
I have a bit of a cold, so I might kind of space out here and there, but I'll move forward. Good evening, Mayor Lee, Mayor Pro Tem, and esteemed council members, as well as distinguished, hardworking city staff, friends, and neighbors. My name is Debbie Peralt. I have lived in the Five Cities community for the past 13 years, and the most recent 10 years, I have lived in Grover Beach at 1547 Brighton Avenue, which is approximately 3 blocks, a 10-minute walk with 2 feet and a heartbeat, a 3-minute drive with good traffic, and about 25 seconds as the crow flies. And I live that close to the proposed project at the current Hillside Church property. And I'm here tonight to express my support for this project. For the past 40 years, I have had the amazing opportunity to be engaged in building healthy communities as a fitness professional and as an employee and volunteer with several nonprofit organizations throughout our state. Through this experience, I have learned, as the poet and author Maya Angelou so poignantly said, "We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike." In every community, we are doctors, we are plumbers, we are educators, we are aviators, we are courtesy clerks, we are crossing guards, we are caregivers, we are parents, we are grandparents, we are children. We are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. We are government officials. We are musicians. We are clergy. We are business owners. We are inventors. We are homeowners. We are renters. We are families living in cars. We are veterans living without homes. We are human beings who are more alike, my friends, than we are unalike. Yesterday, I also attended the informational presentation, discussion, and question and answer session held at Ramona Gardens Park. The majority of the assembly, I would say, were definitely in support of finding a solution to our community's homelessness. However, the majority of the assembly was not supportive of creating a solution at the current projected site, nor willing to hear that human beings who are more alike, like us, than they are unalike, would benefit from this project, become whole members of the community, and contribute to the wellness of our community. One of the questions asked by a participant at the session was directed to the two professionals who were sent by God, I think, because they were angels and very patient with all of us, giving ample time to everyone who had a question. They were Jana Nichols and John Fowler.
Thank you, Debbie.
That's done. Okay, thank you.
So if you would, if you want to give your comments to Matt, then he can.
Okay, thank you.
He can share this. Thank you. Thank you for those. Next up is Kevin Watkins, followed by Kathy Belcher. Or Beechler, sorry, I apologize. So, Mr. Watkins.
Thank you. I wasn't planning on speaking tonight. I'm Kevin Watkins. I live on Newport Avenue, just up the street from the Hillside Church. Like I said, I wasn't planning on speaking this evening, but something struck me when I pulled out of the driveway to come down here tonight. There's a young, newlywed, recently married couple that have moved into the house next door to us, and they are busting their buns fixing that place up. And what I mean, unbelievable. Sweat equity doesn't even begin to describe what they've been up to. And when I pulled out of the driveway tonight, he was out there after a hard day of work, out in his front yard. He's probably, it's still light out, so I bet he's still going. And what struck me is, that's what you want to see in the neighborhood. That's exactly the kind of thing that should be happening and is happening in our neighborhood. And this doesn't fit with it. This is the opposite of that. This is something that would wreck the neighborhood. And how unfair to that young couple that they're investing in this neighborhood just like we did way back in 1995. He's doing exactly what we did back then. So drive up. Take a look. Give that some thought. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Kathy Beechler, followed by Marcia Vieira.
Hi, good evening. Someone earlier expressed everything I thought about the offices and the reasons why that we wouldn't want them here, so I'm not going to go over that again. But we went to the meeting yesterday, and they were pretty evasive about the population that was going to be in there, and maybe that's because it's still a work in progress and they haven't figured it out themselves. But it's really hard for us as the neighbors to wrap our head around what's going to happen if we don't know who's coming in there. They also were pretty evasive about the number of people that would be in there, and that would be my next concern was, you know, that there that the population is, the environment can support that much population without overrunning the neighborhood. And the same with the parking and the traffic. And I think just housing, like adding a diverse new neighbors to our neighborhood is not a bad thing. You know, if it was just, you know, the young families and maybe even the transitional, although I know there was a lot of concern about young men at that age being volatile and potentially a big problem. But if they had the appropriate number of people in the housing and off-street parking, and they already said that they're going to have control in there with someone in there 24 hours, if they had just the support services for the people that are actually living there and not bringing in other people off the street for services, and even they might even have shared services with the neighborhood like daycare, that would actually be an asset to the neighborhood because I know there's a shortage of daycare. That's
all I have. Thank you for those comments. Next up I have Marcia Vieira, followed by Marla Lawton.
Hi, my name is Marcia Vieira, and I live at 1690 Sierra Drive in Rio Grande. I'm within a half mile of the site. I think what I want to talk mostly about tonight is the people's self-help housing component. Let's be honest, they're one of the biggest developers on the Central Coast. I think they're worth somewhere around $400 million in assets. Do we really need to be taking our precious few resources for homeless services and applying it to a company that can full well afford to pay for their own facilities? And I'm pretty naive. I used, you know, I knew what they used to be. They would put single-family home residences together, developing pride of ownership, but that's not what they've been doing the last 20 years. They're building apartments for subsidized housing for folks who don't make quite enough to really live here. I'm not sure I make enough to live here, frankly. And so, you know, that really is not speaking to homeless people. Those are people who are renting apartments and going about their way. When you look at this proposal, there's precious little money that's actually going for homeless services. You're talking 40 beds. Is this grant application worth 40 beds? Now, Five Cities Homeless Coalition will get some brand new offices, but is that really helping homeless services? I just wanted to put these questions out. You know, I'm not sure this particular funding package that's being purported through the Board of Supervisors is necessarily the best use of our precious few funds to actually get services to the homeless people that desperately need it. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Marla Lawton, followed by Deborah Guerrero.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. My name is Marla Lawton. I live at 1479 Brighton Avenue. I've lived there over 20 years. I'm a single senior and living in the area. I oppose the location of the Hillside Church for all the reasons that have been mentioned. And one thing, this is the second time I've spoken to you, and I've been at every meeting that's been held regarding this subject. And something that popped, two things popped out to me. One was when asked by the mayor at Rio Grande, what would you do, Mr. Fowler, if we don't have the, what would be, that we don't have the Hillside project there. First thing he said, well, we back out of escrow. I wrote that down. That can be done. And Adam Hill said at the Board of Supervisors meeting, you know, he is very sympathetic, as I am I, very sympathetic to the needs of the homeless. Personally, I'm very, very sympathetic. But he did ask the question, if not here, then where? And I just thought, isn't that true? We haven't been given a chance to show you where. And I've just found out tonight, yesterday, of a fabulous location that is another location that you guys can consider, as well as there's another one, Griffin Street. There's several locations that has been all that I've been asking is please consider other locations. We have time. We can back out of escrow. There's other solutions. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up, Deborah, and then my last speaker slip is Jana Nichols. So, thank you, Deborah.
Hi, I'm Deborah Guerra. I've been here for 34 years. Oh, I mean, 37 years. Sorry, it's going by fast. And I'm a homeowner since a year prior to that, and I'm a little nervous tonight. I'm sorry. So it would be 36 years. And I just want to say, I spoke last time with this hearing, and I'm going to speak again then. You know, we need to act on this now. Homeless people are here, and walking up and down the streets, I do myself quite a bit, and I enjoy my walks. I look at people's yards, and I see homeless people. I talk to them. I say hi. I've never had an issue. You know, they've been pretty decent, and I'd just like to know, as I'm listening tonight, is how many I've heard how many people keep saying that they have signed the list. How many people refused? How many people have they offered, and they decided they didn't feel like signing the paper because they believe in that? And again, I think I'm for it, and we need to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Jana Nichols, we'll conclude our public comment this evening. If you can keep your comments to 3 minutes, Jana, as everyone else has. I appreciate it.
I will, certainly. And I appreciate your time this evening. Jana Nichols with the Five Cities Homeless Coalition. I'm not going to go through the proposal again this evening. We've had a chance to share that with you at one point. I did want to just make a couple of comments. Certainly the first is, as we all know, homelessness is a very challenging issue for our community, and I certainly respect the concerns expressed, and we have been listening very closely, both Five Cities Homeless Coalition and People Self-Help Housing, trying to find ways that we can find solutions and mitigate some concerns. And as we move forward with our proposal, we will certainly be doing that in terms of looking at additional safety issues and those sorts of things to try to assuage some concerns. There have just been two comments this evening that I think are important to clarify, that with regard to sex offenders, and the proposal before you will include a variety of housing, including housing that will include families, and so there will be no services to any sex offenders provided at that location. The other is, there was some comment about bringing 44 parolees from the prison. That is also a misunderstanding. While there may have been some folks who have been incarcerated for one reason or another, violent offenders of any sort will not be eligible for services. They are not eligible currently, and they will not be going forward. There are a number of reasons that people are incarcerated, including public intoxication and other issues. That said, the folks that we are looking to provide housing to for the transitional housing very specifically are for folks who are 18 to 24, and our intent as we go for funding, and we do not have continued funding secured, that is the next step for a number of programs, but our intent would be to apply for funding specifically serving families with either young children or who are pregnant parenting, who fit the same age demographic of 18 to 24. So parolees from the prison are not part of our plan, and there will be no services to sex offenders. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. I'm going to go ahead and close public comment and bring it back. I do want to just say this evening, excuse me, thank you once again for everyone for participating. And you'll notice that as a city, we are not going to take a position because we are in a unique opportunity, a unique position, a unique situation to where this application, if it should come forward, will be within our jurisdiction. So other boards or other agencies or other entities, for lack of a better term, don't have the ultimate responsibility of taking action on this item. So that is why you'll see this evening very limited comments by us, because as we have expressed and explained in the frequently asked questions document that is on our website, no application is before the city right now, and none has been submitted. That is going to be contingent upon other factors. The city is not a part of this application before the Board of Supervisors for the funding component, and there is a possibility, if an application comes forward, that the city would consider a use permit, a possible zone change, a potential subdivision, which would each have its own separate public comment period, public CEQA environmental documents, at which point we will then weigh the information that is provided to us, which will include the numerous comments, both for, against, and then we've read in the community at that time. So please be aware that we do listen. We are, again, in a unique position to where if an application comes forward, it is going to be our Planning Commission first and then this body, which will be responsible for the action on an application that might come forward. And that would include conditions of approval, conditions of consideration, perhaps conditions of denial, so depending upon how all of this works forward. So for those of you who think this is a done deal, there is a long way to go if an application comes forward. You can agree with me. You can disagree with me. That is your right. You can share what you think is misinformation, what you think is correct information. That is not what's before us this evening. Before us this evening was your comments, your opinions, and we appreciate those being brought before us this evening. But if an application does come forward, then this body, again, will be the authority where that action will be considered. And, again, your public comments and your input will be a part of that process. So with that, I see our Mayor Pro Tem twitching to my left, so I will...
She had really good peripheral vision. I just wanted to thank people for doing their best to make comments constructive. I was approached by an acquaintance the other day that said, you know, I'm a pretty good friend of one of the leaders of Neighbors for Safety, and I don't think that she knows that I'm actually one of the people that would qualify for this program. And I said, do you think you would tell her? And she said, no, because I would never want her to feel badly. And I just want people to keep in mind that we are not, people don't go around maybe with a sign that says I live in my car or I'm poor or I'm rich. And I just want us to keep in mind we're all neighbors and we're all shades of gray. And I do appreciate the constructive comments because I think we need to get there. But I think if you do attend the Board of Supervisors hearing, there may be people in the audience there who've been homeless or have taken advantage of services, and I just want us to keep being respectful of them as well, because no matter what happens, we do need to come together as a community and keep working together on this, because it sounds like everyone wants a solution.
City Manager, was there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, sir.
Very good. Thank you. What's the pleasure of the – that is going to close public communications. How's everybody feeling? Do you want to take a five-minute break as the in case anybody wants to leave the chambers? We'll take a five-minute break and be back at 7:10. Thank you, everyone. Welcome back. It is just about 7:10, so we are back from our break, which we are done with public communications, and that'll move us into our consent agenda. So we do have several items: treasurer's report, for the city, for our bond, $15 million bond measure, minutes of the city council, and a records destruction authorization policy that we have before us on our consent agenda. Is there any members of the council that want to ask any questions on consent?
I just have one question, and it was we received a letter about the minutes, and then also a gentleman addressed that same question here tonight regarding the minutes and how before it was addressed in the minutes whether they were for the issue or against the issue, and about the
So perhaps, City Manager, you could give us a quick kind of a debrief on what the purpose of the minutes and what is put into the minutes from an action-oriented standpoint.
Sure. I'd be glad to. Thank you. Mr. Mayor, members of the Council, by ordinance, has action minutes. So the Council, a number of years ago, adopted an ordinance that identifies our minutes being action-oriented, so they're not summary minutes. They don't have all the verbatim comments, but they're really more action minutes that capture the major actions that were accomplished at the meeting, that were approved. They list the individuals who spoke, but they don't list the specifics of those comments. This is a practice that's very similar to most cities within the county, and so our minutes today do just that. They list the individuals. They do not list the comments. The idea is that if you wish to see the comments, then you can go look at the video archive and be able to get that information. All material that's given to us during public comments is kept. It's routed. It's part of the record, and it's shared with the council. And going forward, that is still our practice and policy at this point.
Okay. Perhaps you can kind of clarify just one more thing, is that during the course of, say, an ordinance discussion or a public hearing, typically as part of the minutes, we will include those in support and those speaking in opposition on a particular item that's on the agenda. So so have I seen that incorrectly, or is that something we do as a matter of an item that's on the agenda versus something that's just under public comment?
That's a very distinct evidentiary hearing. When you have a public hearing, it's intended for the public to give evidence for or against a particular item. Most of the times in the context of ordinances that we do for text amendments and changes, those are mandated by state law. So yes, the minutes will reflect a more detailed analysis of what was said or a description of what was said than the minutes that the city manager was referring to.
Okay, great.
Can I just clarify one thing, please? So previously, on a hillside-related topic, there were comments, and it was identified whether people were pro or against that. I believe that was in connection with when the concept was first on our agenda and not in public communications, which would be in the same vein as what you're just speaking, but I just wanted to confirm that that was correct.
You are correct, Councilmember Lance. We have been in transition towards achieving the action minutes policy set by the council, and that transition has now fully commenced. And so there were indications of support and opposition on February 19th agenda. Those were not consistent with the action minutes orientation by policy, and so going forward, we do enact the action minutes as you see today.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those clarifications. Is there any other questions by members of the council on an item on the consent?
No. Anybody? Not for me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody need to pull an item from consent? Okay. If not, I will go ahead and go out and open this to the public to see if there's any member of the public that wants to speak on an item that is on the consent calendar. Seeing no one come forward, I'll go ahead and close that portion and bring it back for discussion or motion on the consent agenda.
Oh, well, seeing no discussion, then I will make a motion that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
I'll second.
We have a motion. We have a second. Looks like we have a roll call vote, please.
Councilmember Bright.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yes.
Councilmember Lance.
Yes.
Councilmember Nichols is absent. Mayor Lee.
Yes. And so the consent calendar is approved. So with that, we will go ahead and move into our public hearings, of which we have none this evening. So we'll come out of public hearings and go directly into regular business, where we have our Community Choice Energy and Monterey Bay Community Power presentation. City Manager, did you want to do an introduction, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you, council members. Your list of major city goals for 2019-21 includes environmental sustainability. Typically, when the council adopts a set of goals going forward, we really embark on initiatives for those new goals once the new fiscal year commences. Given some timing issues that our speakers will be speaking to regarding the implementation of community choice energy and some unique regional opportunities we see now, we are bringing this item to you at this time, before the new fiscal year begins, but in a way that's consistent with the major city goal that the council has identified in pursuing different energy alternatives, energy-based initiatives, including community choice energy, greenhouse gas reduction policies, along with the Central Coast Blue Recycled Water Project, which is a key initiative the city is engaged in currently. So we're bringing this to you this evening, consistent with other communities who are also looking at community choice energy at the same time as well. So I have a staff report that's included in your packet. I won't belabor the points about community choice energy because our presenters are subject matter experts in the field and will be able to speak to this for the council this evening. I'm joined by Tom Habashi and J.R. Killigrew with Monterey Bay Community Power. Mr. Killigrew will make a brief presentation to the council regarding community choice energy and Monterey Bay Community Power as a CCE agency, and seek the council's questions, comments on the concept. Once they're done with the presentation, there's no action being requested of the council. However, I am seeking council's direction in pursuing potential next steps in the city's possible participation in a community choice energy plan, which could involve bringing back resolution and ordinance at a future meeting. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Killigrew, who will lead the presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mayor and Council members. Thank you, City Manager Bronson. My name is J.R. Killigrew. I am the Director of Communications and Energy Programs. It's a big, long name, but I like to say we're the fun part of our energy. We do all the outreach and engagement and developing good programs to reinvest in the community. I did want to acknowledge the fact that the city does have environmental sustainability as a goal, and we see that as a key facet of that. So it's great to see alignment between our agency as well as the city's goals. So I'm going to walk you through our presentation today. Big question people always ask is, what is community choice aggregation? That is the formal state legislated name of it all. But it allows government entities to create, either from cities or counties, to serve the energy requirements of their local businesses and residents. So you effectively join part of an agency and you become the default electric service provider in partnership with PG&E. How this all came about, because this isn't a new concept. This isn't something that's not proven. It's quite proven. It came about of the energy crisis in 2000 that led to an Assembly Bill 117 that allowed local governments to create these community choice aggregators to become the default electric service provider on behalf of their constituents. Fast forward to 2011, a new bill, a Senate bill, that allowed for community choice programs to participate in energy efficiency. And then in 2012, actually, there was a code of conduct that was enacted to create a level playing field between the investor-owned utilities like PG&E, Southern California, Edison, or SDG&E, as well as the community choice programs. So how it works, it's not a competition, it's a partnership. Trust me, please, it is a partnership. So the way it works in a nutshell is we become the default energy service provider. We go out to the wholesale market, procure a whole mixture of electrons based on our philosophy and needs. Those electrons are then transmitted and managed by the California Independent System Operator. But since we are in PG&E service territory, those electrons travel through the PG&E transmission and distribution system, and then it lands in customer homes. So PG&E takes care of the billing, the transmission, distribution. We take care of where the energy is sourced from and getting that onto the grid. And again, it is a partnership, and we work really hand-in-hand with PG&E. We have a great relationship with them. We know that San Luis Obispo County is definitely a PG&E community, so we're here to rest assured that we're here to kind of work arm-in-arm to make sure that the customers derive the best value out of this model. So why community choice energy? Why would you encourage this, or why would you investigate this? Well, right now, under the current model, you don't necessarily have a choice. You have one monopoly that provides you the generation, the transmission, distribution, and the billing. Now this provides you two options in terms of who is your default electric service provider. You also get a seat at the table in terms of being able to provide a decision-making process about how we set our rates, how we reinvest surplus revenues, and kind of how we manage ourselves in terms of outreach. You don't get that under the investor-owned utility model. And we're here to provide a competitive atmosphere to deliver cost savings, and we've been certainly doing that. And also, most importantly, community-based programs. How are we going to reinvest even more so than you're getting under the current model, whether it's through electrification of buildings, electrification of the transportation sector, or figuring out a whole great other resources to reinvest in the community? Now, I wanted to land on this in terms of operational community choice programs. There are 19 operational community choice programs in the state, and I think it's now serving up to 10 million customers. And this has all happened since 2010. So I want to ask you kind of a rhetorical question of name another not-for-profit sector that's seen that amount of growth in just 9 years. I think it's pretty amazing to see that folks want to see the best of both worlds. They want to see PG&E take care of the transmission and distribution. That's where they profit. But they also want to get more local decision-making and more local generation or more local reinvestment from that generation side of the bill. So it really is a unique paradigm that allows you to get the best of both worlds. Now, who we are, again, we're here. You probably may or may not have heard about us. We're actually the first community choice program to launch that unified three counties at one time. Think about it, San Benito, Santa Cruz County, and Monterey County, and the 16 incorporated cities that are a part of us. And interestingly enough, there is one city that kind of held back, wanted to kind of test the waters, kind of see if we were for real, and that was Delray Oaks. But actually, they're going to be bringing forth their resolution and ordinance next Tuesday to move forward with joining us. So we fully respect everybody's decision-making process, but we do know that our doors are open, and we are here to help kind of bring along each individual community. But I think most importantly, the reason why we're here is because the cities of San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay joined our agency late last year, and we will be serving them in January of 2020. So all of those customers are going to be able to get the benefit of this new paradigm that is delivering cost savings to customers. How we're governed, very quickly, we are one of the more unique community choice programs where we have three boards. We have a policy board of elected officials, operations board of city managers and county administrative officers, as well as a community advisory council. They help set our rates. They help guide our procurement strategy. That is the one major differentiating factor between us and the investor-owned utilities is you have local stakeholders helping to shape this program. And very quickly, the way we're set up, communities that have over 50,000 get a whole seat, and then communities under 50,000, we kind of aggregate those seats under shared seats to kind of keep our board kind of minimal and not so kind of overgrown. Now, why we're different? A lot of other community choice programs have a lot of great opportunities, but we're one of the first that actually set it forth a power supply mix that's carbon-free. Now, think about it. Think about utilities. They basically procure energy supply from different suppliers, and they put that on the grid. Think about the grid as a big bathtub. So basically, with this program like us, you're supporting, you're investing in our procurement philosophy. That's really what it boils down to. We also have 100% renewable energy option for folks who want to get involved in the renewable energy movement. But I think most importantly in the middle of it is the local control and accountability. We are not taxpayer-funded. We don't get a single dime from the taxpayers. It's all rate-based. So basically, we charge our customers our rates, and they pay us for those rates. Now, I did want to do a quick snapshot in terms of the power mix comparison. And again, right now we're delivering 33, we will be, hopefully after this year, close to 33% renewable and 67% large hydro. So that comes out to about 100% carbon-free. Now, PG&E is almost 80% carbon-free, so that includes hydro, renewables, and the nuclear plant. Again, PG&E is a very clean mix, but again, incrementally in terms of the supporting, we've been able to help reduce 300,000 metric tons for our existing community members in just 1 year of service. Now, very quickly, our service offerings, the way it's set up is by default, everyone's enrolled in MB Choice. That's 100% carbon-free. You have an option to opt up to 100% renewable through MB Prime. But the most unique model we have is it's 3.7% rebate now. So basically, based on the customer types, they all get a rebate, every single one, whether you're a small business, big business, whether you're a net energy metering customer, everyone gets a rebate under our model. But the most unique component of it is our rebate option. So if folks want to reinvest even more in the community, they're allowed to direct that 3% or 3.7% rebate towards local programs. Now, I wanted to walk through the bill. This is the biggest question we always get. They go, well, what's going to happen to the bill? Is it going to come in pink or yellow? Is it going to totally turn on its head? Absolutely not. It is completely the same. So I want to walk you through a quick the snapshot of a normal customer. Again, the middle line, I think I can do this. Well, the middle line where it says Monterey Bay Community Power Electric Generation Charges, that's a replacement charge. It is absolutely, unequivocally not an extra charge. It replaces the generation cost that you were spending with PG&E. Now, this is the same second page of the bill, which kind of outlines all the different charges you're paying for in addition to the delivery charges. Now, under the PG&E portion of the bill, it now becomes electric delivery, but I want to point your attention to, I think it's number 7, where it says generation credit. PG&E basically credits you that amount of money you would have paid them for the generation. So you're basically just paying them the delivery charges as well as the other fees that are related to that delivery service. And here's our beautiful new page. So we are now a new page on the bill. We're a replacement charge, not an additional charge. But I did want to walk you through a couple bills. So this is from, we scrubbed a residential customer. Again, they'd only had service for about 5 months because we launched commercial service in March of last year and residential in July. So for about 5 months of service, this one customer got a $6 rebate over the holidays. Maybe it's not huge just that year, but we're going to see that grow and grow over a year. Now, small to medium business, imagine that. They got a $173 credit on their bill off their generation charges. And then a lot of people question whether the validity of this, but I'm not kidding. This one customer got a $14,000 credit on their bill. Again, it's all based on usage. It's not like anybody gets more or less. It's all based on the amount you consume. So, again, there are a lot of big customers who consume energy. So, of course, they're going to get a bigger chunk, but it's still equitable because everybody gets that same rebate percentage. Discount programs. Very quickly, everything stays the same. Whether you're low income on CARE, FARA, you're on medical baseline, you're on LAHEAP, actually even PG&E employees still get their 35% discount on the delivery side of the bill, irregardless of who the electric generation provider is. Rooftop customers. We love solar. We think solar is a great thing for customers to move forward with. Everything stays the same. The only two elements that are different is actually we pay a little higher net surplus compensation rate. So if you produce more energy than you consume, we actually pay you out at 150% more than PG&E. And then additionally, if you consume more energy than you produce, you get a 3% rebate on that excess electricity you have to pull from the grid. So ultimately, customers win out whether they produce more than they consume or they consume more than they produce for rooftop solar customers. And again, I just want to give you a snapshot of how the rebate's deployed. So annually for residential customers for the last 12 months of generation charges. For small to medium businesses, it's semi-annually in June and December. And then for large commercial and agricultural customers, it's applied quarterly. So March, June, September, and December. And actually, interestingly enough, just wanted to share, we delivered $4.4 million in customer savings last year. That's estimated to be well over $8 million, and we're actually looking to scale that rebate up to 5% in 2020, hopefully, based on board approval. So that number will continually go up and up. I wanted to highlight a lot of questions about community choice programs and are you building new renewables, because that's the big push. We need to get to 60% renewable energy by 2030, and then the goal is 100% carbon-free by 2045. We're essentially already there, but we have to meet all state mandates around renewable energy procurement. And again, under the guidance of our CEO, Tom Abashi, he partnered with Silicon Valley Clean Energy, our sister agency in Santa Clara, and we actually inked three large renewable energy projects, and actually the largest solar plus storage project at the utility scale in the history of California was contracted by us in the first year of operation. So we're really excited to continue to deploy the technology that's going to meet our customer needs as well as the state's needs. Again, these are pretty self-explanatory, but I just want to highlight that under our CEO's guidance, he's really kind of put forth, fiscal responsibility is a key tenet for us. And right now we have, I think, up to $57 million in reserves right now. And our goal is to hit our reserve target probably by mid, maybe late 2020 and maybe into early 2021. But what that does is it allows us to reinvest all that excess revenue that we're putting in the bank to weather market regulations or any sort of issues that we need to have. Think about it. Any good business needs a savings account, and they need to be able to have that as reserves to be able to operate effectively. So we're really excited that we'll probably be one of the first programs to get there that quickly. Now, this is another thing that sets us aside. 2% of our gross revenue goes towards energy programs, which are based on our pillars of energy programs, which are electrifying the built environment, the transportation sector, as well as distributing energy resources. So right now, we got a couple great programs. We got over $1 million of incentives for customers getting electric vehicles. We're actually working with grid alternatives to support affordable housing solar installations. So 20 homes are going to get solar, so they're going to be able to get that cost savings over time. Well, we're actually able to bring a $6 million grant to our region for EV infrastructure. So as we develop that relationship with the California Energy Commission, we hope to, you know, granted, if the remaining cities in the county join us, we want to bring those kind of dollars down here as well for those type of programs. Again, quickly on enrollment and outreach. By law, all we have to do is send four mailers. That's all the state statute says, but we're firmly committed to community engagement in terms of getting to know all the major players in the region and making sure people get the word out in terms of what happens. We love doing events, workshops. We are very committed to advertising and sponsorships and developing a community outreach plan. I think most importantly, we're almost done. We've done some preliminary analysis based on the city of Grover Beach residential and customer base. And for the first year under a pretty conservative scenario, we're looking at bill savings of over $76,000. That's under the 3% scenario. If you look at the 4% scenario, it's over $100,000. And if you were to file the necessary paperwork to join this year and you enrolled in 2021, that number is going to be even bigger. And again, the timeline, as City Manager Bronson alluded to, we presented to Paso Robles. They're actually moving forward with agendizing the resolution and the ordinance. We had a great meeting in Arroyo Grande. They're going to be bringing it back as well, and we're here tonight. We're actually in Pismo Beach tomorrow night. We're doing a roadshow. Make sure all the elected officials know about this. But, yeah, the key thing is we have the soft deadline of the end of July to basically do your investigation, adopt the resolution, waive and read the first ordinance as well as read the second ordinance, and then after that it's on us to basically file the necessary plan with the CPUC and make sure we can get all those documents submitted by the end of this year so that the residents and businesses of Grover Beach would be enrolled by early 2021. And I think I wanted to land on the idea of unifying the Central Coast under one banner program. We're certainly open to setting up a satellite office down here if we can unify the Central Coast. We're certainly up to kind of updating our name to make sure that it meets the beauty of the Central Coast, because we are talking with the city of Santa Maria tomorrow, and actually I was contacted by the city of Guadalupe, so we're going to be starting to discuss that conversation as well. So we really feel like being able to bring all of the customer base from Santa Cruz, San Benito, Monterey, San Luis Obispo County, as well as a couple communities that are in PG&E service territory, we can really create probably the most beautiful, dynamic, and amazing program in the state. And on that note, I think I probably did a decent job of 15 minutes. So.
That was amazing. Right on the dot of 15 minutes. Thank you. Thank you again,
our CEO is Tom Abashi, is here to answer any questions as well.
Appreciate that. Let's see if there's any questions. So thank you for the presentation. I just for full disclosure, I did meet with JR and I met with Tom previously as well. So I've heard most of the community choice energy discussion, and but looking to see what questions we might have for JR. Start with Councilmember Lance.
I have a handful. All very exciting. As a lawyer, I always kind of tend to lean towards the liability side of things. And I've seen just some discussion out there regarding CCAs because they're, you know, they're getting obviously more popular, or CCEs, however you want to use the acronym, getting more popular in California, but also other parts of the country. And I know that it's projected potentially for PG&E to potentially have about like $500 million in lost income for people leaving. And that's just from what I've seen on Bloomberg. It's just kind of people talking. And that there was potential of them trying to recoup some of that money on that exit and what that might look like. I don't know if that would be potential litigation. I don't know if that would be have you heard about this? Have people asked about this? What kind of, I guess, assurances can be made in that as far as from a liability standpoint?
Sure. That's a great question. I think there are two components of it. I'll start with one, under the liability. The bankruptcy judge that's presiding over the bankruptcy proceedings with PG&E, they identified community choice revenue as well as public purpose funds as pass-through revenue. So they're not subject to any of the creditors that are going after PG&E around the liability. So that's part one. Part two, under law, any customer – so PG&E has gone into a heavy procurement to basically meet their needs because they thought they were going to be the only game in town. Now, back when deregulation happened and you had direct access customers, you had large customers departing PG&E service to go into the wholesale market. So they enacted something called the Power Charge Indifference Adjustment, and that's to allow bundled customers, PG&E customers, to be indifferent or not be on the hook to pay for customers who depart service. So you think about it, somebody leaves the service, PG&E has already procured a lot of energy to basically meet the needs of that customer, so they basically went out and said, we need to be able to not make our customers indifferent. So that's in effect right now, and all community choice programs, as well as direct access customers, have to pay that PCIA. And so the way we build our rates is we match PG&E's rates. You subtract the PCIA, which the customers have to pay to PG&E. There's a franchise fee, and then you have our cost of energy that's delivered to our customers. So what's happening right now is over probably the next 5 or 10 years, we are in the process of starting to see some of those contracts kind of sunset. And basically, we'll be able to see some kind of relief around that in terms of being able to see hopefully that PCIA decrease over time and then turn to zero because all of those contracts have been satisfied and PG&E no longer has it on the books.
That's mainly what I was getting at, yeah. Because I wanted to make sure that there down the road wasn't going to be kind of a big takeout, but it sounds like with the PCIA charge, or I guess that's already kind of being considered. Okay. And then I guess my other question was just to give a little bit more context as to how the shared seat works and how the board works and where, if we decided to move forward in this, what that would look like for our city. And as more cities join, what is that going to be diluted? You know, just kind of touch base on that maybe.
Sure, yeah. And actually, City Manager Bronson did a great job of cutting my slides down, but I did add some... some other ones, just to show context. And again, yes, I want to preface it. This is just proposed. It's just
yes,
an idea. So the way we kind of see it is based on population size. If the county were to join, they'd have their own seat. The way it's shaken out, the conversations I've had with the city of Paso Robles and Atascadero, they felt like they kind of probably have their own seat together. And then we were looking at Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Pismo sharing just because you're the three coastal communities down here. And then because San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay went first, they already have a shared seat right now. So effectively, we'd be looking at adding just three more seats, so we're 12, possibly now 15. And then if the city of Santa Maria were to join, most likely Guadalupe would be involved with them. And so at a maximum, there'd be 16. But again, if a city does reach that 50,000 mark, then we'd have to honor they would get their own shared seat. So do you see Grover Beach exploding to 50,000 anytime soon?
I don't think so. I think we've had the same population for a while.
Yeah.
Can you go to the slide that kind of shows how you're governed, how many times you meet, that type of thing?
Yeah.
I really want to understand the governance of it because I think that that's something that's already been established to a point, and I want to see how we fit into it.
Okay.
So are you saying the larger ones here, those are all seats, and then these are the communities that share a seat underneath?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, okay. And so if we were to unify the remaining...
We would get added in kind of under... You know, right next to San Luis Obispo cities.
Okay. And those seats do circulate. So we do have turnover, so different cities are allowed to appoint. Within the shared seat, you could have a representative from one committee 1 year, and then it kind of rotates through.
And within the policy and the operations, I mean, the operations meeting twice as much as the policy, there also can be rotation within that.
Correct.
As well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, right now, we do have, because San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay have a shared seat, we do have a call out for a community advisory council member seat right now to join our community advisory council. And they meet monthly to really help us advise and kind of give us feedback about what the community needs. So it's a really great community vessel.
Okay. That is it for now. Thanks.
Thank you for those questions. Councilmember Bright, did you have any questions?
I do. Just a couple of things because I don't know anything about this business. So if you would bear with me here. You talk about electrification of buildings. What does that mean?
Great question. So based on the goals that are set forth by the state to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions, there's sort of kind of a few major avenues to pursue that. So right now, a lot of buildings either use propane for heating and cooling. They could use natural gas. They could use a lot of kind of fossil fuel-based fuels to either kind of power those operations. So the idea is to help incentivize and support moving away from fossil fuels that basically power our lives so that we have systems that kind of act a little more, it's not necessarily naturally, but the built system can kind of be operating as a living, breathing entity where you're using electricity to power all its needs.
Okay. Just basically what it says.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I had heard that there are some folks up there who feel that maybe the community hasn't been involved as much as they wish to be. So you had talked a little bit about community outreach. Can you touch on that just a little bit more, how you go about doing that?
Sure, yeah. So we do our best to engage and reach out to stakeholders in the region as the community is investigating this. But I think the great thing about this model is even when a community does move forward with the necessary documentation to join our agency, we kind of take the baton and do all the filing to the CPUC, but we really kind of spend our time educating people from day one once the process has been formalized, because it is an opt-out program. Everyone does have a choice. So we try to do as best as we can in terms of joining chambers, reaching out to key businesses, working with stakeholders. I know we've got some great advocates from the San Luis Obispo Climate Coalition to basically work with them to help us kind of identify where we need to be. And we really use this as an opportunity to make sure that we're educating as many people as we can about this and that they do have a choice about it. So effectively, you get us to be able to educate and show up and participate in community events kind of for a longstanding, for as long as possible. And the thing is, even once the enrollment happens, folks can always opt out at any time. It's not like once it happens, you're done, you have no choice.
Okay, so all of our residents, should we go forward, they have an opportunity to either jump on the bandwagon or not.
Yeah, so by law, all customers, by default, they're automatically enrolled with us. And then basically, if we were to enroll the city of Grover Beach in early 2021, we start sending mailers out in probably October, November time. The enrollment would happen, say, theoretically in January. And then we send another two enrollments. And basically, from there, they're now our shared customer with PG&E. And then moving forward, you know, for some reason, 6 months, a year down the road, they decide they want to leave our service, they certainly can. There's just an administrative fee that after 60 days of being enrolled, if you don't make a decision, it's a nominal $5 fee. That just helps with us processing it, and $25 for commercial customers.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yeah, just a couple just about numbers. So there's a 3.7% possible rebate. So, and you get that if you're an average customer once a year in December. So, you know, what a money amount would that look like on someone's bill?
Yeah, so a normal residential customer with a 3.7% rebate, you're probably looking anywhere from maybe $15 to $30. So most residential customers on a monthly basis spend between maybe $30 to $60 on electric generation. So while it is for 12 months, it does have a huge impact on that one December bill.
Oh, okay. And then I think I understand, but the reason you're able to do these rebates is because you're a nonprofit.
Correct.
Okay. And then is this going to result in any PG&E job loss?
That's a good question. I may turn to... if I may.
I think it's more likely that the job loss of PG&E will be because of all the problems that they have on the distribution side of the business. Right now, for the generation side, it's all passed through. So basically, once customers leave them on the generation side, they do probably make adjustments in order to get some of the folks that buy power on their behalf to move on, either find another job in the organization or just move out altogether. So I can't guarantee that they won't lose jobs. My guess is they probably will. Most of those jobs, however, are in their headquarters in San Francisco. That's where all the power buying happens.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
As people go to electric cars, you know, that's a good thing, but then I heard it, you know, uses a ton of power off the grid. Are you guys ready for that or prepared to be able to do that?
Yes, and we welcome the challenge. If you kind of look at the trajectory right now of electric vehicle adoption, there are certain places in the state where it is exploding. But I think with good proper procurement planning and be able to plan for it, We see this as a great way to kind of maybe to be able to keep those dollars locally. Because when you think about it, when you go to the gas station, you're filling up, that money basically goes to that gas station and it leaves the community. The more people that are charging their homes with kilowatt hours, they're basically paying us, and then we're able to reinvest those monies back in the community. So it really creates a beautiful loop where as you move towards electrification of both the built environment and the transportation sector, while it may see an increase in electricity use, we'll be able to go out and procure that necessary energy, but also at the same time, those dollars stay locally and can be reinvested locally, whereas the current paradigm, those dollars aren't reinvested locally. They're basically sent out to for-profit entities who are powering most cars with gasoline.
Okay. And then I think my last question, we have, as a city with PG&E, we have these credits that we've built up over years to underground certain power lines. So we're still waiting for that to happen, but we have our credits. Do we lose our credits, or what does that affect anything with getting things undergrounded that are supposed to be undergrounded?
Absolutely not. Anything on the delivery side and the infrastructure side still stays with PG&E, regardless of who the generation supplier is. By state law, they have to treat everybody equally. So if you're in the queue to underground, and I know our CEO loves that concept, he's a big proponent of it. So I think it's just all based on their queue and whether or not they're able to do that kind of work. But, yeah, all infrastructure, again, if you have a power outage, you call PG&E. Anything around the transmission and distribution lines, you call PG&E. They still handle the billing. So everything still stays the same.
All right. Thank you. That's all I had.
Great. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, Councilmember Lance.
I know you like to go at the end. I took a tour of Diablo the other week, and it got me really interested in the portfolio of energy and what that looks like. And I know I read through your materials that it obviously will change based on when the sun's going to shine and when the water's going to turn over. But from a having a choice from – or at least having a say in kind of what that portfolio looks like from a year-to-year basis. Is that happening kind of in the operations board? Is that where that discussion is happening? Or can you kind of just walk through how cities can have an input into that portfolio?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, again, effectively, based on our goal of delivering carbon-free electrons to the grid, ultimately all our power contracts are approved by the operations board. And then ultimately the philosophy about how we're procuring energy. Like we bring forth our energy roadmap every year to kind of give people an idea of what everything's going to cost, what can we do. And then that's how you do have a say, is you have an opportunity to be able to look at kind of what we're looking out into the future and be able to have that voice in terms of how we're procuring for energy. And again, we know Diablo Canyon does produce a significant amount of energy. I think it's 2,000 megawatts. All the CCAs combined, again, in the last few years have been able to bring online 2,000 megawatts, so an equal amount of renewable energy, and it's forecasted that we're going to be able to continually do that. And, you know, as you probably well know, that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is looking at offshore lease opportunities, mm-hmm. and we are excited to know that Castle Wind has a community benefits agreement with the city and the fishermen about potentially building 1,000 megawatts of offshore wind. Again, there's a lot of controversy about it, but again, there are going to be a lot of great resources around in the next 6-7 years to be able to meet that curtailment or that turning down of that right. power.
Okay, thank you.
I think I just have one more question, and then we'll look forward to some public comments on this item. So my question, thank you for the presentation, JR. What happens if Morro Bay Community Power becomes too big to service from Santa Cruz to Santa Maria? So, I mean, what happens if there's a desire on the part of the agencies to let Monterey Bay do its thing and have San Luis Obispo and perhaps part of Santa Barbara counties break away from Monterey Bay Community Power? So what kind of scenario would that look if we say we like our two counties, you guys can have your three counties type of thing? So, I mean, I think go towards the how the – organization is set up to spread yourself throughout the coast.
I'll defer to Tom on that one.
I think in the joint powers agreement that you would sign off to join, basically it says that any community, if they choose to leave, to the extent that the agency did not make decisions on their behalf that will cost the agency money, then you can serve a notice to leave and do so as you wish. If we, for example, went out and acquired or hedged a certain amount of power with the expectation that you...
Actually, hang on, Tom. I think I'm probably didn't represent my question very well.
Okay.
And I'm saying this is a kind of a beneficial split. Let's say that Monterey Bay has gotten to the point of, not that we want to leave, but that we want to form an offshoot with Santa Barbara County, San Luis Obispo County and its cities, Santa Barbara County and its cities, and then Monterey Bay. So it's almost like Monterey Bay, Santa Cruz, San Benito, and then San Luis, Santa Barbara. So it's almost be like a sister company's under umbrellas. Is that ever been thought of, or do you feel comfortable that you can service from Santa Cruz to, you're talking to Santa Maria, so from that length of space?
Yeah, I think that our intent is to have a satellite office over here, and it would be in San Luis Obispo, to serve the community, starting with south of Monterey and going all the way to Santa Maria if we happen to go all the way down to that end. It is difficult to answer your question because I can't figure out from a legal perspective what kind of split that you're trying to aiming for. If it is more of let's break the two organizations and have each organization does its own decisions when it comes to procurement and rates design, then we are two different organizations, mm-hmm. and you are leaving in order to form a different organization. And to that extent, if you would leave the JPA, we would assess the amount of power that we bought on your behalf. We can push that your way. You can take it. And as long as whatever commitment that we made on your behalf goes with you, then, of course, as a community, you can leave anytime.
Okay. I think that answers my question. I appreciate that. Great. So any other questions? City Manager.
Actually, if I could add just one point to that, as the council is aware, last year, the city of San Luis Obispo and the city of Morro Bay did look at forming their own CCE, as that was part of the goals that both communities had. I've been involved in other agencies that have formed their own CCEs in the past, and that is how we've gotten to this point today. However, there's been a recent change in state law that has made it more cost prohibitive to form a new CCE. I don't profess to know all the details around it, but that is a recent change that has now made it more incumbent upon looking at existing CCEs and trying to scale and expand those versus trying to form one off the ground, which is ultimately why San Luis Obispo and Morro Bay opted to join Monterey Bay Community Power to fulfill their climate action goals with an agency that had a shared purpose, a shared mission, without forming their own CCE and then scaling it and expanding it from that point forward. It still could be done, but the laws have changed and the costs have changed to make that less advantageous.
Okay, great. Thank you for adding on to that. Any other questions before we do public comment? Great. I do have one speaker slip, Mr. Bruce Severance. So if you would speak, and then if there's any other members that do want to speak, please turn in a speaker slip.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to address the council. My name is Bruce Severance. I've worked as a volunteer for Slow Clean Energy for about 5 years, which recently became Slow Climate Coalition. I am an energy analyst and a policy analyst, and I work at the state level on decarbonization of buildings and the statewide economy with a team of about 100 analysts that make recommendations to the legislature and the governor's office on how to accomplish that. I'm a fiscal conservative. I really believe in leveraging, dollars for these types of programs and figuring out the least painful way to do it. And I have to deal with fiscal conservatives a lot in conversation about that. So I do a lot of cost trade-off analysis and program cost analysis as part of what I do. By far, community choice aggregation is like the win-win, where it's not costing us money to lower carbon. We're actually saving money by lowering carbon. And this is one of those unique places where it's a win-win for everybody. you know, as far as businesses, ratepayers, for the state, for agencies that are trying to monitor their carbon reductions. So it's one of those rare categories and kind of the first thing we want to do to decarbonize the state economy. I've talked personally, really driven by my passion on this subject, to about 80% of the businesses in Grover Beach on Grand Avenue over the last two or three weeks. I've done the same in Arroyo Grande, and I've just started to cover part of Pismo Beach. I have not run into a single business owner that thought this was a bad idea. And I reached out primarily to business owners, obviously, because they're so well-networked, and each one of them knows 500 other people in the community. And they tend to have your ear more. I've encountered many people, and I'd say well over 70% that were genuinely excited about this and who felt a sense of relief because they're worried about climate change and, oh my goodness, can we go 100% renewable? Is that even possible? And yes, we can do that. And they're genuinely excited about the possibilities of this program. The key thing that I've said to almost all of them is this is an opportunity to vote with our energy utility dollars. You get to decide that money, instead of expanding any kind of carbon-based fossil fuel generation, is going to go into offshore wind or other viable opportunities that will help harmonize the grid in combination with solar. We can only expand solar so much more without causing grid harmonization problems. And people are genuinely excited about the opportunity to get to vote with their utility dollars. This, along with the potential for reinvestment in community projects at the local level, I think makes this an opportunity to grow and expand jobs in our own community, with the prospects of doing offshore wind and plugging into about $500 million grid infrastructure that exists at Diablo. We have the opportunity to grow jobs in the community and in the county as well. And so I want to just encourage you. Thank you very much for your time. Encourage you to call me. I'm happy to leave my number and email address with the council, and I can address any of these comments in greater detail.
Great.
Thank you for those comments, Bruce. Next up is John Smigelski. I apologize if I said that incorrectly. And that will be followed by Susan Ross.
You get a gold star for your pronunciation. So I'm with the Slow Climate Coalition, a countywide citizens organization focused on climate change. And we have members from Grover Beach. We've been advocating for community choice energy in this county for 10 years. So we support the expansion, and we're really pleased with the positive response we've gotten from the city council so far. And I applaud you for your sustainability goal. By joining them, carbon emissions from electricity reduced because you'll have over 6,000 megawatt hours of carbon-free electricity coming into your town, more than you had before. But it also supports your economic development goal. $10,000, if the 3.7% rebate, staying in the community, coming back as the savings, being able to say, City of Grove Beach, we use 100% clean electricity, attract your tourists. So it hits two of your major goals. And I appreciate interest in the advisory structure because this is a chance. You get to choose what kind of energy, the savings for your customers, and where businesses and where economic development can come from. So I hope you agree to move forward. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Susan Ross, followed by Justin Bradshaw.
I'm Susan Ross. I am a resident and homeowner here in Grover Beach, and I just want to say, please get on board with this. We're running out of time, and that's all I got.
Well said. Next up is Justin Bradshaw, followed by Travis Higgins.
Hello, Council, Mayor. Thank you. I just wanted to reiterate a few of the important points here. The win-win for everyone is I know it sounds too good to be true. This presentation, it kind of is true, all of it, and we can all win from this. One of the reasons I've been so into it for the last 6 years since I moved here is because I bought solar panels, and I get my power from the sun, and I want everybody else to. And this program will incentivize people to not only do that with their money they bring back into the community, but with these programs they start, but also by building a bigger system than you would have otherwise, maybe, because you're going to get paid back a little more when you overgenerate. Just in case it hasn't been mentioned, the greenhouse gas free versus renewable distinction. Right now, Monterey Bay Community Power is greenhouse gas free, which includes large hydro, and they're working towards getting that large hydro out of the mix, so it's 100% renewable whenever they manage to achieve that. But renewables, solar, wind, biogas, and stuff. I wanted to also put a fine point on one of the things that JR mentioned about rebranding. It's our hope at the Slow Climate Coalition, which I also represent, and Monterey Bay Community Power has been very receptive to this idea of rebranding this program as Central Coast Community Power. So it is our vision that everyone will feel completely part of this and ownership of it. I want to also add that for those residents who don't feel like they've been a part of the conversation or this process, the Slow Climate Coalition is open to everyone. We have a website, carbonfreeslow.org. We have public meetings. We welcome all inputs and all perspectives. One of the other things I wanted to put a fine point on is the PCIA, which is that fee that PG&E gets from the community choice programs, it just got increased, and it has made PG&E kind of whole. They got what they wanted, and that's what stopped Slo and Morro Bay from creating their own program. So if you're wondering why there isn't a program just in this area, that's why. And we joined them because there's a bit of a scale that you have to make this thing work. The rates... The fact that they can come out with so many millions of dollars extra per year and put money back into the community is partly because they have newer contracts because we know that the price of renewables has been going down quickly. PG&E has a lot of older contracts that are more expensive, so they're just not as nimble in that way as these community choice programs are.
And I'll give you one more comment if you don't.
One more comment. That's all I got.
Okay, perfect.
And in terms of the community engagement part of it, right now, if you want to have a say in how your utility dollars are spent, you have to go to the CPUC up in Sacramento, and they don't care about you. But these programs, as you can see, there's 4, 8, 12, there's 24 meetings that people can be involved in just with this region. So there's huge opportunity there. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you adopt this as soon as possible.
Thank you for those comments. Next up is Travis Higgins, followed by, I'm going to say, Rita Cassander. Cassander? Cassandra? Oh, that. Yes. Travis.
Ms. Hello, Rita. Mayor. Hello, Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm new to the area. I'm a resident of Grover Beach. And one of the first things that I did when my wife and I came back here with our families, get involved with the Slow Climate Coalition. One of the reasons is because I'm excited about this new energy. I'd like to apologize to Councilmember Karen and also JR because I had some flyers that I was supposed to give out as far as outreach goes. My family and I went to Lopez Lake this weekend, so I will give those out maybe in Pismo. But I'm excited about this idea. I'm excited. I'm an engineer myself. I'm excited about the energy projects. That's good for my business as an independent consultant. One of the flyers I did give out was to my father. He recently retired from Diablo Canyon. He's looking to put solar on his house, also in Grover Beach, and he's excited about it as well. He didn't come down here, but he's supportive to the idea. So I think it is a win-win from a cost reduction perspective. It's a win-win from an economic development perspective, and I'm personally excited about it. So I do hope you go forward with investigating it more and thinking about joining up. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. So, and my last speaker slip is Rita. So if anyone else wants to speak in this item, please go ahead and fill out a speaker slip.
Hello. Yes, my name is Rita Casaverde. It is a strange last name. Not many people have it, so it's fine.
Thank you for saying it again.
I am the chair of the Slo County Climate Reality Project. And our main goal as Climate Reality is to bring awareness on the climate crisis. So it is very exciting to be going from city to city, knowing that a lot of our cities in Ora County have goals that have to do with sustainability and climate action. So thank you for including that. A lot of our members are just spread all over the county, and we actually have a series of events that are happening at the end of this month and at the beginning of May that have to do with climate. And in all of the events that we go to, one thing that we always get asked by parents, by kids, by grandparents is, what do we do? What is the one thing that we can do to make a difference and to avoid catastrophic consequences, like our scientists are telling us? And the one thing is, I think, the opportunity that you guys have to make this decision and to move forward with this program, I think it's unique, and it's one of the things that you can do as parents, as grandparents, as uncles and aunts. I think it's the one thing that your family, your kids, would be very proud of. So we have been posting the city council meeting or social media, and we are getting a lot of comments from people that are very interested and hopeful that you guys move forward with this program. So yeah, that is it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Casaverde, for those comments. That is, if there's anyone else that wants to speak on this item, please come forward. Seeing no one else come forward, I'll go ahead and bring it back to the council for discussion. So, any other questions
I had
generated?
I just had one question.
Sure.
From some of the speaker comments. And I did remember reading about this in the packet, but I wasn't sure what exactly the community projects are. So this is if somebody decides that they don't want their 3.7% rebate, they put it to the community project. So what does that look like? What kind of projects are they?
Yeah, great question, Mayor Pro Tem. So if I'm just going to run forward a little bit. Here we go.
It's one of those reserved slides.
Yeah, so great thing. So it's 3.7. So sorry, we're a little behind. So 3.7. So if somebody wants to take their whatever it's $15, $20, $30, or even we actually have some larger customers that are donating thousands of dollars, they can go to two options. So Embry Green Plus is about local energy projects that could be help supporting affordable housing projects, that could be supporting, you know, local development. Or MB Share, which actually we work with the three major foundations, both in Santa Cruz, San Bernardino, and Monterey County, to help them kind of fund local climate efforts to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And actually, we met with the San Luis Obispo Chamber today, and I saw up on their placard that the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County is involved. So if we are able to unify, that we would have to be able to have dollars that flow directly to that county foundation, directly for projects just in the county. So it's kind of all allocated based on participation. But we do look at helping to fund additional funds through the energy program's budget as well. So it's not just the couple thousand dollars. It could be $20,000, $30,000, or even $100,000 grants that are available.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, City Manager, was there anything you wanted to wrap up on that? So if not, we'll go ahead and bring it back. What's the pleasure of the council? So I think what the action before us this evening is to obviously hear the presentation, and thank you, gentlemen, and for all the speakers, and then determine if we want to give direction to staff to move forward with the next steps, which I believe would be bringing back a resolution and an ordinance to join or otherwise participate in Monterey Bay Community Power. So,
well, I think it sounds like certainly something we definitely would want to consider and research. Certainly something we wouldn't want to let us pass us by, my opinion.
Yeah, I would like to move forward with the resolution and ordinance and have city staff follow up.
Very good. Any?
Yeah, I think coming into this, my biggest concern was what I now know to be the PCIA. However, it sounds like that could potentially be a larger issue for future CCs wanting to kind of start up their own operations, whereas because, and nod or go like this if my understanding is not correct, but because Monterey Bay Community Power is already established, I don't want to call it grandfathered in, I don't know another word for it, but you've already kind of
Do you want to speak to that a little bit, that our liability up for the PCI has already kind of been...
No, we're not grandfathered into a number. However, any actions that PG&E makes after the day we launched, which is 2018, any additional resources that they buy, regardless of how expensive they are, they're no longer in the calculations of the PCIA.
Okay.
However, that PCIA number changes from year to year, subject to market price fluctuations. What they do is calculate the difference between what they pay for power and what the market price on the wholesale is like, and the difference between the two becomes the PCIA. So the number, the PCIA, changes from year to year. The expectations, however, that as the contracts that they have begin to run
expire,
then the PCIA number keeps going down eventually until it disappears.
So your projection for the PCIA is going like this and not necessarily going like this?
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. So I'm hearing consensus from the council to move forward with the next steps to consider the resolution, or to have staff bring back an ordinance and a resolution towards that. Is that something we need a motion for, or is consensus adequate for on this item?
I believe that council consensus is sufficient for this. And with that direction, what I would do is to bring the resolution and introduction of the ordinance to likely a June council meeting. We need to have the ordinance second reading adoption by July 31st, and so bringing it in June would allow us to have the second reading done in time with that timeline.
Okay. So that sounds like good direction. So I just want to confirm just for the gentleman from Monterey Power so that that time frame meets your time frame in order for the city to participate as of 2021. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be correct. Yep.
Okay. Very good. So I think that is a good direction. We will look forward to having that come back. So thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. So very good. So what's the pleasure of the council? Anybody need a break, or are we good to proceed? Continue to proceed.
Let's do it.
Very good. Then thank you. So we will go from energy to skate parks. So in keeping with
energy.
With the
one energy to another.
One energy to another, exactly. So, very good. So this will bring us to our South County Skate Park Operations Report. City Manager, are you giving the presentation?
I am looking for our Parks and Recreation Director, who is likely just coming over here.
I see her.
As we speak. So I will introduce the item and allow her to be able to change over the presentation. So let me just introduce the item by recognizing the importance of partnerships, which you just heard about in the last agenda item. We have a long-standing partnership with the San Luis Obispo County YMCA on all different levels, all different fronts, from programs to facilities to skate parks. I wanted to personally thank the YMCA for their role in assisting us with the skate park for the last several years. And I think what's before you, as Ms. Petker will introduce, is a recommendation that it really is a win-win for all parties involved, and I think allows us to continue and find other opportunities to bolster our partnership with the Y going forward and be able to offer the skate park in a different level than we do today. So with that, I'll introduce our Parks and Recreation Director, Kathy Petker.
Good evening again. Thank you. I believe the city manager did introduce Monica Grant, San Luis Obispo County YMCA CEO. Welcome. So the South County Skate Park is a facility that the city built in 1999. It was the first in the San Luis Obispo County. We do allow skateboarding, inline skating, and non-motorized scooters. They are approved. Originally, it was unfenced, it was unsupervised, and it had open access when it was originally built. And we did experience some vandalism and some delinquent behavior. And I believe I'm showing you the wrong slide right now. I meant to show you this one to give you an orientation of where you are when we're talking about the skate park. I'm sorry. Got my little things backwards here. So the skate park is located on Ramona Avenue. It's just west of Oak Park Boulevard, It's one block up from West Grand Avenue, and it is 13,000 square feet. You can see there. And I just wanted to have that opportunity for you to see what the location looks like, 13,000 square feet. So, again, we talked about the background, built in 1999, and all that information. And this is a picture of some youth at the skate park wearing the full gear, helmet, elbow, and knee pads. So, after about a year, the city was experiencing issues at the skate park, and we installed the 8-foot fencing, we hired city staff, and we began charging an entrance fee. And literally overnight, the park changed. It became safer. We were able to add programming. And over the years, additional skate parks were built throughout the county, and we were able to enter into an agreement with the YMCA to take over the staffing and the charging and provide operations and services. And our partnership with the YMCA has been going on for many years. It's been a positive experience, and we're very thankful for the services that they've been able to provide for youth, as well as the mentoring and the camps and special events and operations for our city. It's a great asset. And we've recently, in the last year, been discussing the possibility of reverting operations back to the Y. I'm sorry, back to the city. Although the Y has been doing a great job on their work, the city is currently in a good position right now to take over management again of the park, and with our forward-looking fiscal impact that we're hoping for. And part of our research in determining this recommendation, we did do contact with the county. We did reach out to all the other local skate parks and the agencies, as well as our city's CJPIA carrier. And the feeling of skate parks are a positive asset. It generally reaches the young male customer. And few incidents have occurred, and it's really reaching a good exercise outlet for youth. The most feedback we got from the other agencies with that skate parks are more positive and impactful if you have a positive volunteer assistance and people take it on as a project, and that they protect it and realize the asset that they have available to them. And then also having regularly scheduled special events and birthday parties and contests as well. And the challenges of skate parks, and throughout the research as well, is that gaining compliance with the state laws related to the public skate parks, specifically Assembly Bill number 1146, section 115800, as the city attorney would probably quote, health and safety code. And essentially, that refers to the requirement of full gear, a helmet, elbow, and knee pads. And technically, if a city is not staffed, it does need to post the signs, the regulations, and the law to help indemnify the city from any issues. And I will let the city attorney expand on that if the council would like that as well. Also, skate parks are considered hazardous recreational activity. So that is another reason why we have to post those rules. The other issue item that I learned throughout the research was that with this generation of the existing skaters and the skate parks in the county and the state and the country, is that most agencies are moving toward the non-staffed and non-fee-based system. Essentially, rules and hours are posted with the reference of the law, and the successful parks do continue their daily maintenance, and repairs are completed so there's not accident opportunities. And then the local law enforcement regularly patrol the skate park and keep an eye on it as needed and provide violations if necessary. And in our research with our local PD, our chief stated that in the last 2 years there's been 18 calls to service in the past 2 years, which is really low, plus the fact that the YMCA has been on site. And here's a summary of all the local agencies that were contacted. And I know you've had this in your report. I'll just highlight that in discussion with the county director, the county oversees the Los Osos, the Napomo, and the Templeton parks, and that the new park being built in Napomo is proposed to be unstaffed and non-fee-based as well. This item was reviewed by the Parks, Recreation, and Beautification Commission. They did recommend that the city resume direct operations and to be non-staffed and non-fee-based. And staff is recommending, based on council's direction, to perhaps start this beginning as sooner, if not by July 1st. And we would need to come back to the council with an amended ordinance and new signage for the skate park. The fiscal impacts would be the cost to prepare the facility for use, including any identified repairs to the landscaping and concrete that Public Works deems that needs to be prepared for use, public use again. It could be approximately $30,000, and then additional ongoing maintenance would also need to be determined as we work out those monthly costs. So the recommendation is to receive this information, and the recommendation from the commission as well, and to resume the direct operation of the skate park and provide direction to staff. Thank you.
Thank you for that that report. Is there any questions of staff? We'll start with to my left, Councilmember Bright.
Thank you. Well, I really just have one that I can think of at the moment. Nice report, Kathy. Thank you. So those calls for service, now they don't include like citations for not wearing the safety equipment or anything like that, do they?
They could. The specific calls, I'm not positive. The police chief might be aware of that, but they can if they're not wearing the gear.
I don't know, if, police chief, if you want to answer that now or gather questions and then come back, but we'll start with this one.
Whichever you prefer.
Well, you're there, so.
All righty. Yes, John Feeders, your police chief. Just wanted to let you know the majority of those 18 calls for service were actually violations of people trespassing on the property after the park was closed.
I see.
Very few, if any, citations were actually issued. I'm not aware of any citations that were issued in reference to not wearing safety gear.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
That's it for me at the moment. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I was thinking, I bet you a lot of those citations are kids climbing the fence. The one question I had was just how the maintenance is going to work, the $30,000. Is that going to be to open the fence and we just see how it goes, or is that to remove the fence, or what is going to be within that 30? What kind of repairs are going to happen? What does that look like?
That is going to include existing repairs to our irrigation system, mainly to get the grass growing again quite well, and as well as any repairs to our restroom, any repairs to the fence mechanism, those types of items, and then if there's any concrete that we need to repair. So it could be less. It could be more. We're estimating at this point until we can do an overall evaluation.
But you think you can have it done by July?
Yes.
Okay. And
or we will make it so that it's safe.
Yeah.
And I don't know that all of it will be done, but we won't open the park until it's safe.
But kids can hopefully get in there this summer. And then so you'll probably for now leave the fence but just have it open.
Yes, so the plan is to leave the fence up, and that will be as part of a safety component as well. Mm-hmm. We don't want kids going out and skateboards going out and kids chasing skateboards and or any other items. But right now we plan on keeping the fence up for sure.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Councilmember Lance.
My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, was also to lock it up at night or whatever the hours of operation are, right?
Correct. We're planning on dawn to dusk,
yeah.
And we will be working with a system similar to our existing parks and our restroom maintenance program where our contracted janitorial company would clean them in the evening and clean our existing restroom that is in the skate park and then lock it and then our have them open up in the morning as well. So we would be open dawn to dusk, essentially.
And just out of curiosity, what's the current fiscal impact of the contract, and are we looking at savings? Is it kind of a...
Right now, we're currently reimbursing the YMCA for some maintenance items and up to about $6,000 a year. So this will be an increase in our services, but mainly because we need to bring it back up to standard to open it because we have had some irrigation issues that we need to repair.
And actually, that's going to lead probably uncomfortably into my next question, which is, and it's been a good partnership between the Y and the city with regards to operations of the skate park. But with if we're seeing approximately $30,000 in, I'll call it deferred maintenance. So we were doing maintenance through the course of the several years while the Y was operating this. So why are we coming now with this, what I'll call a fairly large balloon series of maintenance now? Why was this not done on an annual basis as we were expecting during the course of the operations by the city?
I can take that question. I would answer it in a couple different ways. One is we have had significant deferred maintenance at many park facilities and assets over the last several years. This contract, this arrangement started in 2015 when the city was trying to stay afloat financially, and the YMCA was gracious enough to step in at that point and help us, realizing that we were not devoting the type of resources to our maintenance funding as we should, not just at this facility but other facilities. We did a bare amount of maintenance, but since then we've seen that our needs have increased. And just as the council has asked us to put more funding and focus on park maintenance across the board, and you'll see that actually in your next agenda item, that goes into this item as well. We realize that there is some additional work that's necessary that we haven't been able to get to and haven't devoted the funding to get to, but that is now changing given where we are financially. So I think that's the biggest item I'd point to. Secondly, I would point to I think a realization that this facility is going to be used much more extensively than it has been in the last several years, and there's a higher expectation level in the overall maintenance and upkeep of the facility. Not that we shouldn't have had that beforehand, but it's even more of an onus on us to make sure for an unlocked facility that's going to be open dawn to dusk every day, there's going to be a lot more wear and tear, a lot more usage, a lot more activity. So we have to get to an even higher standard than it is now.
Okay. Thank you for that response. So now from back to Kathy and the review by the Parks and Rec Commission. So obviously this is going to fit into the matrix of the other deferred maintenance at our other parks. So this is effectively moving ahead of a number of other projects that the council was kind of anticipating were coming. So how do we, is the Parks and Rec Commission fully supportive of that? Are the users of the other parks hearing about this for the first time, or has there been any outreach to them to say, hey, if the city brings the skate park back into operation by the city, we need to spend some Parks and Rec funding at this facility, and it may delay other projects? What kind of discussion has been had?
Had that exact discussion during this topic, and that they did understand that they agreed that they wanted this project to be a priority based on that information, and that they understood that the other CIPs that are currently being addressed from the matrix are part of the budget and are going to be planned out as well. However, that with summer coming and kids being out of school, that they understood that they wanted this to come forward to you as soon as possible to get it open.
Okay. And I'll just add that the maintenance funding that you'll see in the proposed budget next month includes funding above and beyond this amount that's being identified here in recognition of the interest from the council in improving maintenance across the board, not just at this facility, but in other facilities as well.
Okay. Very good. Then I guess my last question surrounding that is if we do decide to move forward with this evening and the park becomes effective, a city park again for skate park as of July 1st, our fiscal budget starts on July 1st. So Do we need to make accommodations to have this $30,000 in this year's budget in order to accomplish the safety improvements necessary to open it on July 1st, or would those safety improvements start after the fiscal year?
Based on the, or pending the direction of the council and whether to proceed in this direction, we could work out the time frame in concert with the YMCA and at a minimum be able to have the basic safety improvements ready to open up on July 1st so that we could offer that experience for our customers. We also could shuffle things around to be able to provide more service, more maintenance funding before the fiscal year begins, depending on bandwidth of our crew and contractors to get that work done. So I think the time frame can be a little bit loose and close to July 1st as possible. We'll have to talk further with the Y about what the time frame is on their end, but around that time frame would be great for us.
Okay, great. Did anybody have any other questions? Councilmember Bright.
Yeah. You've perked something here. Do we know what we expect the annual maintenance to be for this going forward?
The main expense will be the irrigation and the system to run the water. I mean, that is the main expense because it's got surrounded by grass, and bringing the grass back because it's died. And we had some unforeseen irrigation lines break that we weren't aware of, so those types of things will be the biggest cost. The actual bowl is safe. Currently, we would not still be open if they would not be open if it wasn't, so it is a safe facility. We do have some painting and those types of things, and possibly restriping the parking lot, some minor maintenance, but those are the main things.
So the grass is really the major maintenance cost?
Yes.
Have we ever considered artificial turf?
Yeah, we have actually considered that, and that's excessively expensive.
I'm getting artificial turf as we speak, and it is expensive.
I know it is expensive, yeah. But I mean, over the course of, yeah. I don't know, anyway, but okay.
Or even drought resistant.
And actually perhaps, either the drought resistant or perhaps the mm-hmm. kind of piggybacking upon that, Ms. Petker mentioned that there was community support for either maintenance efforts or something of that nature. And I know just construction of the park in and of itself was garnered a lot of community support mm-hmm. and community donations. So I'm not sure if maybe that's something that we can ask that is pursued to see if there is someone out there who might want to support the park in that fashion.
So I'm just wondering if it's going to be a major expense.
I think we will know much more over this next year as the park is used in this different manner than it's used now.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be able to identify what that number is for annual ongoing maintenance and report that back to the council as part of our upcoming budget discussions.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? No. I'll go ahead and open this up to the public and see if there's anyone who wants to speak on this item. Ms. Grant, I'll give you the first opportunity, and Mr. Gottschall, we'll have you go next.
Thank you, Mayor Lee, and esteemed members of the council and staff. I'm Monica Grant. I'm the CEO of the San Luis Obispo County YMCA. I've been here since 2013, and our partnership actually started back in 2013, at least discussions, because I know when I got hired, I was told, oh, and there's going to be a skate park. That cinched the deal for me. For me, and I just wanted to reiterate what City Manager Bronson said this evening, that I'm really grateful for our what I think is a very collaborative and productive relationship between the YMCA and the City of Grover Beach, as he said, in many ways. I think for us, the YMCA, we're all about youth development, healthy living, social responsibility. I think having managed the skate park now for several years has been positive. I think for us, it's we want to be able to access more kids. I mean, that's why we're doing what we're doing. And when you staff an operation that has limited the number of hours we can be open, that's our main expense is staffing. So currently, the park is open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And we did add Thursdays and made those free in response to the City Council's desire for having a little more, it's $3 if you're a member of the Y. Now it's free on Thursdays. So we did that. We also, with your help, brought scooters into the park, which I think made it more accessible to all kinds of kids, and especially a lot more girls started coming, which was, you know, I think a positive. So for us, you know, we want to be able to see more kids use the park. We do encourage it to be safe, and I think your plan will have a safe environment. And we want it to be low cost or free. So for us, it's a win-win. I want you to know that the Y has, we have considered this a mission program for our Y, and therefore we have been willing to absorb a financial loss of the skate park pretty much every year to the tune of $7,500, and that's due to staffing. You're not going to recoup. A skate park is like a swimming pool. You're not going to make money in a skate park. But we've been happy to do that, but I do think it's the right time to turn it over, and I think it'll, the youth of the community and families would benefit. I would encourage you to continue to make that park as family-friendly, whatever that term means to you, because I do think it's wonderful to have families come out and just spend time with the together at the skate park and not just have a place where kids get dropped off and, you know, that can be a different dynamic, quite frankly. So I do like that idea of a family-centric park. That's all for me. Thank
Very
you.
Good.
Thank you, and I encourage you to consider this for a positive vote. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those comments, Ms. Grant. And Mr. Gottschall.
Kevin Gottschall, LifePoint Church. I'm curious, is there any room for a creative, a conversation that would allow for creative collaboration with a church, with the city, working together to, I mean, I don't have a solution. I've got an idea, but it's better stayed in my head right now. So, but I mean, is there an opportunity we could sit down? Who would we sit down with to brainstorm some of these ideas? Because our next staff hire at LifePoint is a youth guy, and so wanting to give back to the community some way, and wanting to somehow maybe offset some of these costs, help the city out. What direction would we go to talk about that?
Okay, so I'm going to actually go ahead and finish your comments, and then very good. So I think from my perspective, is there anyone else who wants to speak on this item? Seeing no one else come forward, we'll go ahead and close it back and bring it to the council for either Ms. Petker or Mr. Bronson to answer Kevin's question. My anticipation is that would be one of the two of you, but who wants to Rochambeau for his question?
Your answer is correct, Mr. Mayor, and as a starting point, I'd be glad to talk to Reverend Gottschall and discuss options further. We always like creative solutions in addressing our facilities and public issues.
Very good. Great. And thank you for offering that opportunity. Appreciate it. Great. So with that, I'll bring it back for any discussion, any thoughts. Where do you want to go?
I to my left, think it's to my positive. Right. I did like Ms. Bright's comment about potentially looking at, and this is obviously a tangent because it's really about whether we open it back up to the city for the city operation, but a discussion at some more down the line regarding drought resistant, that would be helpful from a cost perspective since, like Ms. Grant said, we're not making money off a skate park and we definitely won't be making money off a free skate park. So, just a conversation to have later. But I'm a proponent of taking it back and making it something really cool, and I thank the Y for all their service the last few years. But I'm kind of excited to see where this goes. I anticipate my son is going to be the scootering type of kid, so I think this would definitely be something in my near future that I will be attending. And yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you for those comments. Anything to my left?
Yeah, I'm super excited about this. I really thank the Y for stepping in. It's not a cost savings, like it's a cost spending, and it's not easy to find reliable workers who are going to show up and open gates. It's been hard, and I kind of wanted to take down the fence a couple years ago, and I'm so glad you guys kept looking at it and kept figuring out, can we do it? I know I have two really active kids, and we have never been to the skate park because we can never get the hours right. We can just, you know, we have things during that time. But there are other times that they're looking at me bored, and we couldn't go when we wanted to go. And then I've spoken to a lot of kids who just couldn't afford it because they want to go every day. They were really into it. And just so I just think it's so great for them. And you know, I have a fourth grader, and I hang out, I've seen, had over to my home, my own number of fourth and fifth and sixth grade boys, and I don't know that these kids are going to be angels and they're going to be perfect, but it's a place for them to be rather than running around the streets and skateboarding on the tennis courts. And so that's a good thing. And I think I really would reach out to the community on this, because I think there is a way to maybe even have like a peer-to-peer, maybe like patrol or just kind of reminder of good behavior. I know the owner of the Ransom Scooter Shop does a lot with the kids who go there and tries to kind of instill good values. So I don't know if there's a way in the community, maybe there could be some sort of code of conduct that kids maybe try to adhere to. But I did try to take my kids to the scootering there on one of the free Thursdays. And it happened to be a day the worker had to take off. And so, I mean, this place, these kids were lined up. It was probably 10 to 15 kids, you know, that showed up at the right time to do it. And they were disappointed. And we were all disappointed. The Y was disappointed because the person wasn't able. And so this is just so great. And I really, no matter what it takes, whatever the grass looks like, let's get it open for the summer. I think it's going to be great. So thank you.
I agree. I think it's truly an asset to the city and something that, I know when it was first done, my son was young, and people enjoyed it have enjoyed it for a long time. So certainly something that I think we certainly need to go forward with. So,
and I am supportive of it as well. So just a couple logistical questions, if you can kind of humor me as I go forward. So for the city manager and/or the city attorney, so. Obviously, the city operated the skate park previously. Is there not a previous ordinance or resolution that we can revert back to rather than bringing back? Maybe just needs to be refreshed versus a brand new ordinance. I'm just wondering if we can take a look at that and whatever the most expeditious fashion of that is to bring it back so that we can be open as soon as possible.
I unfortunately don't know the answer to your question, but certainly we'll do that. Okay. If there's any current ordinances in place that would suffice for the statutory requirements, we'll do that. If not, then we'll bring it back as expeditiously as possible.
Okay. Very good. And then secondarily would be just to kind of go back to what our conversation was earlier about trying to find either through the Parks and Rec Commission monitoring of the situation to, or as a recommendation from that committee to say, here's a project to either consider drought-tolerant species in lieu of grass or all the way to some level of astroturf, even though it's not called astroturf anymore. But
synthetic lawn.
Synthetic lawn. Thank you. So crushed tires or something. So some other function to perhaps allow the reduction of water usage for landscaping purposes and so forth, so that that way we can actually put more funding into upkeep of the bowl and making sure of that. So, and then one question for the chief, if you don't mind, and it has to do with since this is going to be an open facility, and I know one of the questions that we had concerns about when it was first opened way back when was bullying and angels not participating in skateboarding, and obviously the culture has changed in skateboarding. What happens if we do find that there are injuries there that are caused by bullying or whatnot? So how do we protect what would our hypothetical next steps be beyond that if the situation does change and it does go back into a situation where there's altercations on site?
Yes, if we're notified of disturbances or fights that have occurred, and obviously we'll take the appropriate action and deal with those individuals that are causing those disturbances and obviously engage the parents if they're juveniles. Additionally, we'll also talk with staff and Kathy's staff about what would be a best recourse in order to prevent those moving forward. And as other community members come forward, maybe there is some assistance or some other ideas that come forward that could help prevent those or even eliminate them if they do occur. So,
okay. Great. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. So, I mean, I think we've got good, clear direction to staff. To let's have a free skate park. So I think everybody can enjoy. So, and I do want to echo the sentiments of thank you to the Y for their participation over the course of the last several years in working with us to make sure that the skate park remained open, and also thank you to Parks and Rec staff for coming up with some creative solutions for next steps. So, with that, we will move into our last item of the evening, which is our Major City Work Program, Major City Goals Work Programs, and 2019-20 Budget Update. Mr. Bronson.
All right. Rounding out our evening tonight, our last item, as the mayor mentioned, is the fiscal year 19-21 Major City Goals Work Program, and then an update on our budget for next fiscal year. Before I begin, I'd like to recognize and thank our staff team, all of which are in the room now. Our directors have worked diligently on the material that is before you this evening. One point to mention is that this is not a budget hearing. The budget hearing is coming up on June 3rd. This is really more surfacing. The work that we've been doing for the last couple of months, following your goal-setting meeting on February 22nd and your adoption of council goals on March 4th, we've been working very hard at identifying work programs that respond to those four major city goals, and then developing some initial preliminary recommendations of things we're looking to include in next year's budget, which you'll receive next month in preparation for your budget hearing on June 3rd. So this is really more surfacing, daylighting where we're going, and getting any questions, comments, input the council has at this time as we finalize our work for next year. So jumping right into it, again, we're sharing our programs, work programs, providing an update, and receiving your input and direction as appropriate. This is really down at the bottom of the chart, the work programs. The council received status of current goals, community input, our long-term fiscal forecast, all of which informed the work goal-setting session you had on February 22nd, where you identified the three sets of categories of goals, and now we've drafted work programs with 57 different tasks to support the four major city goals, which will inform the budget for next year. As you know, there are three different categories of goals. The major city goals are the highest priority, top-tier goals that the council is laser-focused on with work programs to accomplish each of those goals. The other important goals are other important goals to accomplish with funding associated within the next year's budget. And then the address as resources permit goals are ones that are also important on the list. They're important to make progress on as resources make themselves available and allow them to be implemented. This chart here is one that you've seen before back in March, which identifies all the different goals that the council identified. The ones on the very left are the major city goals: economic development, environmental sustainability, public safety, and street and other capital improvements. And then the ones on the right side in the two different categories, other important goals and address as resources permit. So this is your set of goals, which you've defined as identifying the key priorities for the city of Grover Beach to accomplish in the next 2 to 3 years, which really guides the work of our staff and our resources in accomplishing these goals. So we've taken each of the four major city goals and developed a work program that helps us scope the goal and ensure that we as staff have an understanding of your expectations for what to deliver on these goals over the next fiscal year, realizing that these four goals are multi-year in nature. We're not going to address everything in economic development in one fiscal year, but we've identified key tasks that we believe are important to focus on to help make progress towards accomplishing each of those goals. You'll see in your packet a draft work program for each of the major city goals that identifies a goal statement, the key tasks, the time frame of those tasks, key operational policy issues, and then the resources that we believe are necessary to achieve those tasks next fiscal year. I'll stress these are all still draft. We're still finalizing, fine-tuning these work programs, and we'll take your input tonight if you have any additional comments to help us land on the final versions of these. That will be part of your budget document that you'll get in late May. We do have a number of recommended budget changes that we'll be putting forth in the proposed budget that helps to achieve or make progress towards achieving these council goals. These budget changes include the continued implementation of the fire Authority planning efforts to help continue to change over the reserve firefighters to permanent firefighters. I'll note that next fiscal year, this will take place at the Grover Beach Fire Station. This current year took place at the Rio Grande Station, so the next phase is changing over three reserves to permanent at our fire station in Grover Beach. I'm also looking to recommend a new police sergeant position and to increase a part-time records position to full-time in response to the public safety major city goal and in response to the police audit that the council received in 2018, particularly in the area of our police sergeant position to provide additional field supervisory capacity and expand our field operations area. The Central Coast Blue Recycled Water Project is tied into our environmental sustainability initiative, which is really a key area for us to focus on this coming year, along with Community Choice Energy. We do have funding for economic and business development assistance tied into our economic development funds. And of course, we have many millions of dollars for street improvements and other capital projects, a capital budget of $18 million proposed for next fiscal year. In terms of our budget highlights, we do have some targeted general fund investments that I'm looking to make within next year's budget as part of the proposed budget that you'll see this coming year. I believe that these investments are important to help continue to address council goals, to address council priorities and organizational needs as we go forward. I have listed a number of those within the staff report, and I can speak to those tonight if you wish. But in general, these investments help continue to make progress towards providing the level and scope of public services that our community is expecting of us in Grover Beach. I am looking to also make a reduction in the gap between revenues and expenditures for next fiscal year, which the financial forecast estimated at about $500,000. Right now, this stands at about $200,000 through stronger than expected revenues, both this year and expected for next year. So we've been able to shave down this temporary gap to just a couple $100,000. The final numbers are still being worked out now, so we'll have a final number to you in May, but that's what we're looking at this time. Even with these investments that are identified in this staff report, we're looking at landing next fiscal year with ending reserves at around 25%. For the council's reference, the minimum reserve policy is 15%, and the policy goal is 20%. So given the revenue growth that we've seen, in a number of different revenue categories, and with these investments that I believe are important to continue making progress towards our council goals, we're still landing on a higher reserve percentage than your goal or your minimum. And that's a good spot for us to be in financially. I'll add that future surpluses going forward in coming years would add to this reserve number based on the projections we see today. So this does enable the council during your budget process, your budget hearing, to look at some opportunities for additional one-time investments if the council so desired. Lastly, I did want to address the topic of nonprofit funding requests, as this is an annual process that the council does consider. We have a practice of considering funding requests from select community-based organizations. The funding choices and decisions do vary based on council direction, council allocations each year. We don't, at this time, have a set policy governing and guiding this this process that was on the work program this year. We weren't able to get to it given other priorities, but this next fiscal year is a time when we would hone in on that as part of the 2021 budget process. This current year, we have $15,000 allocated from the Successor Housing Agency funds with about that same amount close to it from the general fund to fund a number of different organizations. What I'm proposing at this time is to fund these groups at predominantly similar levels based on city manager discretion from what the agencies are looking at. Bring this forward to you as part of my recommended budget, and then the council can make final deliberation allocation choices on June 3rd during the budget hearing and set those for the coming year. So with that, my recommendation is to receive the draft work programs, and provide any input or feedback if you desire to receive the update on the budget process, and also provide any input or direction as you see fit. And then we will go forward and finalize our work over the next month and deliver a budget to you in late May. With that, I'd be happy to take your questions and comments.
Very good. Thank you for that presentation. We'll start with Councilmember Bright. Do you have any questions or or input before public comment.
I do have some questions, and I have some input. First of all, excellent report, really some good news. Thank you for that. So, first of all, my first question is item 8, page 4. I don't see item 8 anywhere. Oh, this is this item. Oh, good lordy. I made these notes too long ago, apparently. Yes. So regarding the nonprofit part, if there are other nonprofits that are not on this list, how do they request to be included in these requests?
What has occurred in the last few years is that there have been some groups that have received funding in each of those years, and there are some other groups that have made themselves known to the council, to the city, and tossed their hat in the ring, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And the council has considered those. I think one the more recent ones is Home Share Slow. They received funding this year as a new funding allocation. What I'm proposing for next fiscal year, pending council direction, is given where we are in the process, we're in mid-April, we're finalizing a budget over the next month, to kind of set the current groups and allocations at roughly the same amounts. We can deviate a little bit, but keep to the overall amount. And then for next year's process, look at it differently. Look at it as a potential broader, more open process if the council wishes to have a nonprofit funding request allocation, and have other groups be able to consider funding opportunities in a more open manner. But again, that's subject to your direction on how you wish to see nonprofit funding be included within our budget.
So then for this budget cycle, is it closed to any if there are other nonprofits that might want to throw their hat in the ring, so to speak? Is it a done deal?
I wouldn't say it's a done deal. I say if the council provided policy direction to have a more open process now, then we could carry that out and bring that back to the council as part of the budget hearing process in an expedited manner.
Okay. I just know that there have been some people who have come and said that they've started a new nonprofit, and I just don't know how to tell them to do what they need to do, or tell them that it's just too late, or what I'm saying.
I think that would be a good discussion to have. So let's hold kind of that thought. I think till after, if there's the myriad of public comment that's going to come forward.
Yes.
I think there is an opportunity for us to have a discussion of what we want to see direction-wise to the city manager. He's obviously proposing a methodology that he and I have spoken about. Typically, we've got the nonprofits coming forward and basically presenting to us.
Right.
Where I think that's always been very subjective last minute type of approach. And I think what we've talked about is here's the funding from the council level. Give some objectivity to the city manager to say he, as a city, with council direction, has this much money. So you're going to get this much, you're going to get this much, and then if we want to next year have perhaps a scholarship style of discussion. But this would kind of be a gap year from that perspective.
Okay, so we're going to talk about this later.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Excellent.
If there's a desire to do so, which I think there is.
Okay. Then I have one more question at this point, if I may.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So this is under, this is regarding public safety goal statement. Oh, complete the police department's strategic and succession plan.
I will defer to the police chief to provide some context.
Police chief, please.
What succession plan, I'd like to know.
Okay. So back in 2018, we started a process where we had a firm or a couple of consultants come in and do an outside audit of the police department. And that helped lay some of the foundation that we needed going forward in building where the department should be currently and where it should be several years down the road. The strategic plan that we're actually preparing and put together, myself and Commander Lamone already attended the training for it recently. We will be preparing that strategic plan to help give it, the council and staff a path forward for the department for up to a five-year process. In that strategic plan will be a succession plan, which is to identify those individuals, as our audit did, where our average age is over 40, and that several members of the department are actually eligible for retirement now mm-hmm. and within the next 5 years. So that succession plan will help to identify those vacancies that could occur and what we need to do to prepare for those vacancies and moving individuals from one rank structure in the department up to the next rank. So providing them with training, experiences, and so forth to get them prepared to absorb the roles that will eventually become vacant within that 3 to 5 year period.
I see. Very good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Actually, I'll go to Councilmember Lance next. Just kind of shaking things up.
I don't have anything specific, actually, at this point, which I'm a little bit surprised by. But
well, that's okay.
Just I'm surprise yourself. Holding my breath, I know.
Okay, that's okay. So we'll go to Mayor Pro Tem Shaw.
The city manager and I kind of walked through this step by step the other day, so I don't have any questions right now.
Very good. So I just have one general question on it's an economic development goal statement, attachment number 2. So which has to do with under tourism development, item number 4, which reads, initiate discussions regarding formation of a tourism business improvement district to promote tourism in Grover Beach. So I remember having kind of a generic discussion with regards to that as part of our discussions with the chamber. And I just want to make sure that as from a council perspective, and perhaps this comes back after we hear from public comment, whether spring of next year is the right time to do that, or if there's a timing for that that may feel a little bit more either expeditious or delayed based upon our hotel development or our tourism development. So, Miriam, you may have some thoughts on that based upon your Cal visit slow items. And then my second question, generally, and actually I should probably let the city manager respond to my first question before I go to my second one. Yeah. So anything you want to share on that?
Sure. And this item is pretty loose, to be honest, and the time frame is pretty loose. The interest is, as part of the TOT increase discussion last year, there was discussion around forming a tourism business improvement district and when would be the right time to look at a separate assessment from marketing Grover Beach. We're the only community that does not have a T-bid, so to speak. And the consensus was wait until you had a little bit more inventory, you had a little bit more infrastructure in place, or at least you had some key projects moving forward from a construction standpoint to be able to have that conversation. So my thought was initiating the discussion doesn't mean we're going to work towards forming a T-bid immediately, but just to begin a conversation with the hoteliers, with the chamber, with other folks in the community about what this could look like, knowing that it'll take a while to have that conversation. It may be until the end of 2020 or early 2021 when we can actually look at forming a T-bid if that's the desire of the hoteliers, but just to start the conversation towards the end of this next fiscal year so that we didn't lose track of that possibility. We also could delay that until the following fiscal year as a possibility as well, as it's really more of a outward type of task.
Okay, great. Thank you for that meaning. And then on the same attachment, but later on down under permit processing, this is going to be a question for Mr. Buckingham. So the engineer in me likes our city engineer, public works director Ray's. Item number 1, begin update of engineering city standards and specifications under July 2019, and then completing them in January 2020. And then I see continue to implement other recommendations from 2018 development review study to streamline development review processes under planning. And I see it as ongoing. So I'm wondering if you have a self-imposed deadline of which you would like to complete your development review updates and process improvements?
I could probably start with that answer, and then Mr. Buckingham could add to that if need be. The work program here is designed to be as task-driven and timeline-driven as possible, and you see there are key deadlines for most of these items, knowing that some items may be adaptable based on conditions. And so all of the items here do relate to the development review study and enabling to meet key recommendations from the study, but there are going to be other ones that are coming forward from the study. We don't have the entire implementation plan here before us. We can bring that back to the council at a later date to go over the recommendations more in detail. But we are making progress on the dates here, and we can provide further specificity to the council outside of this process on other deadlines as we go forward.
Okay, very good. It was the recovering engineer in me versus the planner.
I was just going to say we are making slow progress, but we are making progress.
While Mr. Buckingham is up here, actually, can I ask one question under permit processing? Mm-hmm. Just to confirm my understanding, number two, work with AG to explore opportunities and shared. Is that in anticipation of potentially changing our contractor or them phasing out?
A couple things regarding that. So we contract with JAS Pacific for all of our building services, building official, plan check, and inspection. Right now, we share an inspector basically part-time in both cities, creating a full 40 hours between the two cities. So there has just been some preliminary discussions about could we share some resources there? Could this be somebody that's hired in-house and then shared? But it also goes to the point that we do need to have an RFP for building services go out here in the next 6 months so we can explore are we getting the best service? Are we getting the best price? And the contract, quite frankly, is very old and outdated, and that needs to be part of the update process.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that. Any other questions? Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckingham. So seeing no other questions, I will go ahead and open this up to the public and see if any member of the public wants to speak. I see no one come forward. So we'll bring it back for discussion and direction to staff. Anybody? Councilmember Bright, you want to start with your comments and thoughts?
Well, I don't think I have much in the way of that at the moment. It was a great report. Since I wasn't really part of all this at the when this was all settled, I think it's great. I love the task list with the dates. I think it's it's very workable and really gives us a sense of how things are going to go and gives us an idea of when we can expect it to be done, as well as for the staff as well. I don't have much more to say than that.
Okay.
Thank you.
No worries. So do you want to have a start off the discussion with regards to the service organizations? So do we want to have that conversation first? So.
Sure. I'm telling you. I certainly don't have any reservations about giving our city manager the discretion to, in relation to that, if we come up with a number and then we go forward in that respect for this year, since okay. We're kind of behind the gun here, I'm fine with that. How far do you want to go with this?
So I guess the question becomes, if we're good with the process of basically us establishing a benchmark number and then providing a direction to the city manager to, as he's laid out, predominantly share the same revenues or the same contributions with similar groups. If we're good with that really vague kind of structure, then we see how it works. I mean, I think the three from the successor agency of 5C's Homeless Coalition, Home Share Slow, Housing Trust Fund, I think are are similar to what we've done this year, and I think the expectations from those groups are probably similar for next year. I think where we can provide some additional leeway to our city manager is that what I'll call that second $15,000, which in last year was actually $14,500. But if we round that up to $15,000 from our general fund and give the direction to our city manager to say, as a number of organizations come to us throughout the course of the year, say $2,500 as a benchmark towards a contribution or based upon the value that they bring to the citizens of Grover Beach, mm-hmm. that might be some direction that we give to the city manager. So I don't know if there's discussion on that or
no, I agree with that. Other. Are you talking about, just so I understand what's proposed, keeping it this way for this year but for next year, or are you talking about for this year?
So for this year, I think the discussion, and the city manager can chime in, is $15,000 from the successor housing agency and then $15,000 from the general fund. Mm-hmm. But then giving him the discretion to say from the general fund specifically, there was not an imbalance, but Sloan Knorr Foundation is predominantly higher than the other organizations. Perhaps there's a fourth organization that comes in from the general fund, and the city manager goes and says, I'm going to fund that organization as well, but perhaps reducing the Sloan Knorr Foundation to a little bit more in line with the other organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I like how it looks now. I think we put a lot of time and talk into it last year, so it kind of reflects last year. One thing I was just thinking as we were sitting here is maybe it's hard, because this is one thing I talked about with the city manager, was we don't want to become our own mini grant program, because mm-hmm. that's so much staff time where all these people are submitting. And mm-hmm. I think we are in Slo County like a capital county of nonprofits. Like there's mm-hmm. nonprofits everywhere mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, that's true.
So that can get kind of dangerous as far as just money and consuming staff time. Just, I was thinking one thing, if we thought that we should at least have a little bit of an open door to other organizations, if maybe we found in the budget like $2,000 to $5,000 to say, okay, this remains. If you're a new person coming forward, at least for this year, maybe it can be divided among the new people. And then for next year, like the city manager may have a way to come up with a different way. But I just wouldn't want to see a ton of time put on this, because this isn't really our area.
Right.
And that's very true.
Yeah. I think that's where, if we basically set a cap of $15,000 from the general fund mm-hmm. and then give the discretion to the city manager with kind of ongoing conversations that he has with us individually to say, this organization has come forward, I'm proposing to give them this contribution. Is there any or maybe as an update to a city manager's report type of thing, so he can have that funding throughout the course of the year. It doesn't have to be at the very beginning of the year.
And that's true too. Yeah. And truly some especially some new startup nonprofits, $500 or $700 can mean a huge deal to mm-hmm. They don't need $1,000 or $2,500. I mean, that could really mean a whole lot to getting them started. So mm-hmm. I think that's a really good idea.
So with the understanding that our first priority for these organizations is the benefit that they're going to provide to our
residents and our
businesses in Grover Beach. So
absolutely.
I think that goes without saying.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Yeah, my comments would be, I just don't want it to appear that it's just a shoe-in year after year of the same mm-hmm. nonprofits, mm-hmm. Because I think that gets a little... I mean, maybe that's not the case, but from an outside perspective and new profits coming up, I know there's been one or two people that have stood up here telling us that they've started a new nonprofit, and I don't know if they've made formal requests for money, but I haven't seen anything come across my desk, at least. But I think just, I don't know, taking some kind of steps to, like you said, open it up a little more so that there isn't that stigma of kind of, it's
the
same old
groups.
If there's some leeway for new groups to get in, I think that's only fair.
Mm-hmm. There's some policy direction for you.
Yeah.
Did that give you
a heard?
Very good. So, any other discussion on that topic? Or
not on that topic.
City Manager, do you feel you've got a good framework?
I think I have a good framework for some degree of flexibility while keeping to these categorical amounts, and you know, I'll work with that and put something in the proposed budget for next fiscal year that you can respond and react to and ultimately decide upon at the June 3rd budget hearing.
Very good. Any other specific discussion items that anyone wants to have?
I think you had brought up the T-bid. I didn't know if you wanted to talk more about
sure.
that.
Sure. So, and I think my thought process was along the lines of, yes, it is going to take us some time to go there, realizing we do have some economic development slash hotel complexes coming online. I don't want to be too far in advance of that. I don't want to be too far lagging behind of it. So, I mean, if we start a T-bid and start trying to attract tourists to the city and they've got no place to stay, then we've done ourselves a disservice.
Well, and I don't want to start charging our existing hotels. But, right. You know, that gets, I think we do have to do it at the right time because we'll need community buy-in. Yep. So, what I heard was I think the date's pretty flexible, and I think for now it kind of needs to be.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think it sounds like that spring 2020 would be kind of an update and see where perhaps several hotel or other tourism related businesses are online and see if it's at the right timing. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Sound good? I just had one more comment generally about the budget, because this used to be, I think, the worst part of the job for me. I hate numbers. Now that having been in this since 2014 and just seeing how far we've come, and my mom always says you have to stop and like celebrate all the wins, especially when we hear a lot of negative things. This is really great. I mean, really. And this is based on the work, so much staff work, and so many brave decisions by past council members that are finally, you know, coming to fruition as far as, like, getting out there and getting that grant funding and regulating new industries and welcoming them into our city. I mean, having a 25% reserve possibly when we're sitting here getting things done that we thought we would never get done. I mean, I came in this as the recession was ending. You know, that I really just commend everyone. Like, this was actually a joy to read, this budget document.
Yes, it was.
Thanks. So with that, I'll add a little opportunity with that in the fact that we, as the investments come in of about $200,000 projection. How do I say that? So we have an opportunity for additional one-time investments, the last bullet on the city manager slide there. So, I mean, I think we can provide some initial direction if we so choose tonight to perhaps say have the city manager take a look at what the rate of return would be if we were to make an investment to pay down our PERS liability versus maintaining that 25% reserve. And perhaps that's a discussion that, depending upon how the budget goes through the course of this year, he comes back at quarter two, a mid-year budget next year, and say, but we earmark it, but we don't commit to it until January of next year, and say, put this one-time investment into the budget, realizing that that's a better investment strategy in our city's future, but don't pull the trigger on paying that until we actually see what materializes after Q2 of next fiscal year. So it's kind of one of the things I'd like to take a look at, from have the city manager see what that does from that, and then also making sure that our Five Cities Fire Authority contribution. I know there's still some discussion around where that budget is going to
land.
Whether there may be a request by another agency to defer that, but I think we should remain committed to making sure that we fund that that reserve to permanent firefighter amount. So, which I want to make sure I'm pretty confident it's in there. Mm-hmm. If not, we want to make sure that it stays in there. So, those are just two items I wanted to bring up with that. So, if there's any concerns, discussion, or direction that we want to give the city
manager. I agree with those suggestions. Paying down CalPERS is,
I love that idea.
Yeah, it's like paying down your mortgage.
Yep.
It's not fun, but it's a good idea.
Helps you sleep at night.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. Okay. So one last opportunity then. So, and this will be a something that is a possibility for next year. And the fact that AB 1090, if you recall, there is the potential. Did I get the number right?
It's actually SB
1090. SB 1090. Thank you. Where it's the PG&E economic funds that are slated to come back to the county. Mm-hmm. So those are not currently in our budget because we don't know what timing it appears as those are going to come back to us. But it appears more and more likely that there is a higher level of probability that those funds are going to come back to us. Mm-hmm. So if and when those do come to us, I think a direction to staff would be prudent to say we really want to put X number of dollars towards hard economic development and maybe some soft economic development, not knowing what those are yet. But I mean, whether it's business retention or whether it's investment in the co-work housing opportunity that may be before us. So I just wanted to kind of plant some seeds to see if there's discussion or thoughts around that. So.
I did actually talk to Mr. Bronson about this when we met about the agenda item, because I thought that some money towards, I don't know if you'd call it business retention, but business beautification almost, maybe some seed money for businesses to use to kind of upkeeping their, or, you know, kind of upgrading their look. Especially along Grand Avenue, I think that would be a good use of funds, whether it's a matching type of situation or whatnot. But I don't know if you would consider that hard or soft. I would think that'd be more hard. But
I think that could be more of a hard investment, and I'm thinking perhaps a soft investment would be as the sign ordinance comes forward, or maybe this becomes a hard investment too, as a sign ordinance comes forward and there may be an opportunity to advance a more uniform compliance with the sign ordinance, that may be a location for us to do some investment as well. So I see the city manager did want to have a comment, I think.
Yeah, I just want to add that, yes, this is a tremendous opportunity for us over this next year. You'll note that the Economic Development Work Program has only $20,000 associated with it, which is a low amount. But that is in anticipation of receiving these funds over this next year, which would be an estimated $190,000 in one-time funding that is not part of our budget today. So to the mayor's point, this is likely, very likely. It's a matter of timing. And so what I would suggest is to bring an item back to the council to really flesh out further some different options for these economic development funds. I could bring in some examples of what other communities are looking to use with their SB 1090 funds and be able to lock into the council's expectations for how best to leverage these one-time dollars for economic development benefits for our community. And then we could use that direction to help provide those funding opportunities once the funding does arrive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when we do look at options, we should also, you know, looking at other cities is always a good thing, but also just looking at how we are in Grover Beach. We kind of have our unique, we're very, you know, and I do, the thing I hear the most is, can't you make everything just look better, you know? And it's like, I don't know, you know, and that's not what they're saying in the AG Village. Like, that's something we have. So, you know, really thinking of things, and we have small businesses and how we can help them. And, yeah, just these things, mm-hmm. I think we need something that's unique for us.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay. Any other suggestions, comments? If not, we will look forward to having this come back as part of the budget discussion. Great. Thanks, everybody. I think that was a good opportunity for discussion. And but I think that concludes that item, which concludes our formal agendized item this evening. So let's turn to council committee reports. Desi, any council committee reports that you need to report on?
I did attend the Water Resource Advisory Committee. I want to say RAC, but I'm going to use the full. And mainly budget stuff and the committee's recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. One thing that was changed following some discussion among the committee was allocating some, for lack of a better term, seed money towards the acronym RDA, I believe, was used, but I think in the context of more rural areas regarding groundwater recharge. So giving opportunities to outside of kind of city agencies, the ability to kind of have more private projects, I suppose, to help with that groundwater recharge. So.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Karen, any committees for you?
No committee meetings. I do wonder, though, if the Zone 3 will go before the County Board of Supervisors this meeting.
I don't know the timing of that, but I can...
I guess I can look on the agenda myself.
Perhaps the city manager has been in contact with someone from the county to see if there's a agenda item moving forward to have Ms. Bright named as our representative to Zone 3.
We will check with the county to confirm that.
Okay.
For the record, I was still not a voting member on RAC. They said it should be done next time. So I think they're just taking their time getting around to this.
How long can that take?
I could say something, but I won't.
Thank you.
Very good. Miriam.
Our air pollution control district meeting we didn't have this month because we didn't have any pressing business. But I do just want to reiterate, May 1st is going to be an APCD public workshop, 6 p.m. at the South County Regional Center to discuss the current state of the dust control plan, which seems to be now moving along and is getting to a point where it's amenable for both sides. So I'm really looking forward to it. Well, wow. I mean, the plan. There's a plan. So not too optimistic, not too pessimistic, just planning to go. The other meeting I had was of the Homeless Services Oversight Committee. I will say I've sat on the committee for 4 years. We've had probably two members of the public there in the 4 years. So this one had over 100 people. So that was surreal. And because there were 18 HEAP grant applications submitted. So as a committee, we had to approve the grants so that they could go public, but we weren't allowed to see the grants. It was only a subcommittee that had gotten to read them. So it was just a very strange situation. And then of everybody on the HSOC who was even party to any of the 18 applications was recused. So suddenly we had like 13 of us. Normally we have about over 20 that could even vote. I became chair of the meeting, which I never chaired before, because everyone, Kristen Barnage, the chair, was recused. So it was a long meeting. There was a lot of the comments we heard tonight, same people. This is like my fourth time. And then some also other comments. And so we asked our staff what their recommendation was, and you heard some of this tonight discuss of A, B, C. The staff grouped of the 18 in groups called A, B, and C and said and had different labels. But then when I pressed the staff saying, well, does this mean you rank any of the groups? No, they're just groups. So then I was the chair, so I was pretty quiet. But I didn't feel that I had very much guidance at that time from the staff report. So we listened to all the public comment, and Supervisor Hill put together a motion, and it was seconded by Carlin Christensen of San Luis Obispo, and the recommendation of the HSOC for the HEAP funds, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but it was a large portion to go to North County to be shared in the Paso Robles facility, possible homeless shelter, and ECHO, and then $500,000 for detox to help with detox at in San Luis Obispo City at the Prado Day Center, which is very needed because that was all going out of county. Paso was $1.7 million, thank you. And then the recommendation was for $3.5 million to go to the South County project proposed by Jana Nichols and of Five Cities Homeless Coalition, and even though she wasn't allowed to speak and was recused,
So, and then people self-help housing. It was a strange meeting. So that's what it was. And it was, I had planned to abstain because I thought, well, what if this ever comes to Grover Beach? But I mean, I didn't have to. And I must say, every single person from all around the county that sat up there who really had a lot coming at them, it was a lot. They stood up for this, and the vote was unanimous to support that recommendation, which I thought was very brave and a good moment in government, because it was people voting for money to go to parts of the county and projects that weren't theirs. So it was heartening, and we'll just see what the board does with the recommendation. So, interesting meeting.
Great. Well, thank you for that update. I did have one meeting. It was the Integrated Waste Management Authority, and it was decided to bring on a new general manager. So the process is complete. The gentleman's name is Brooks Stayer. He's coming to the authority from the Merced area, brings a long history and a long background, and a number of service, and secondarily, a number of service contracts with the county were also entered into for HR services, audit services, and IT services, so that the additional checks and balances for the organization are solidified. And then also purchasing policies. It was de facto following of the county's purchasing policies with regards to public contract code and entering into contracts for services and for equipment and for construction. So with that, the interim general manager will finish up his duties on or about July 1st, and then the new gentleman will come on board at that time. So I think all in all, a good opportunity to change the messaging of the organization and get back to the policy and the procedures of which it was created for. So with that, any League of California Cities Policy Committee updates that we need, or just
no updates? Just our next meeting is May 17th, a Friday, and it will be in Paso Robles. It's going to focus, I'm pretty sure, they're still figuring that out for sure, but economic development and what that means. And there's a lot of cool events associated, so I will be there. It should be fun.
Very good. Great. So that'll take us to council communications. Anybody have any council communications? We'll start with Karen.
None that I can think of. Thank you.
Very good. Miriam?
Nope. None for me. Thanks.
Okay. Very good. Desi?
I don't think so, but I'm going to confirm. I always leave it up on my screen. No.
Okay. Then I do have a couple, one of which was as I was talking with some members of our business community, and they wanted to say thank you in one fashion, and they wanted to challenge us in another fashion, in the fact that they were quiet on the fact that we as a council and we as a community are supportive of our business community, but we don't kind of shout it from the rooftops, so to speak. And so I made a commitment that I would kind of begin to kind of use this forum or this opportunity to kind of identify things that we've done as a city to improve our business or what steps that we've done to improve what I think is our business opportunities in town, some of which is where we've improved our planning standards, we've improved our planning processes, which streamlines the opportunity for people to get building permits and to move forward. We've brought in the broadband network that we've talked about and given people opportunities on Grand Avenue to have high-speed internet, which will give them an opportunity to really grow their businesses. But we've also done things like improving our commercial zoning standards downtown to allow for additional customers and families to come to town with some higher density opportunities, and then which brings more tourism to town. But then we've also, with regards to, I know there's always a concern with homeless or transient opportunities, where we've put in ordinances and safeguards to protect the front doors of businesses. And I know our police community and our emergency services are doing a good job of trying to move people along where we can and trying to make sure that our downtown is safe and our business communities are safe. So I just wanted to give an opportunity to say that and to kind of as a council kind of reiterate the fact that business retention is one of our strongest economic drivers drivers in the community, and hopefully we continue to remember that. So with that as the backdrop, and I'm sure the city manager will expound upon this if I forget something, but there is a business engagement community meeting coming up on April 26th at 4 p.m. at Ramona Garden Park Center, directly after the Arbor Day tree planting. So come get your hands dirty planting trees, and then we'll roll up our sleeves and get dirty talking about business engagement. And then we do have an opportunity for a kind of a state of the city address that I'll be giving at the Chamber of Commerce breakfast on May 8th at Ramona Garden Park. So would love to have you join me there so I can kind of introduce you and make sure that we as a city and city council provide the state of the city, not just me up there. We are a council. So if you're there, I'll happily have you join me. And then lastly, there was an Arvacanian dinner where they had their installation of officers over the weekend, and Cesar and some of the maintenance crews were able to unearth several time capsules that were kind of alluded to by a member of the Arvacanian and the Filipino community of San Luis Obispo. So we found them. And we were able to open them that evening and realize there was a lot of stuff in there that was shared and packed into those time capsules. And I think the city manager and I have been talking. We need to share this many times with the community. And so with consensus from the council, I'd like to ask that he agendize something probably before the end of the fiscal year. We'll leave it at that to kind of share the unveiling of the time capsules here, perhaps bring them to the Chamber of Commerce breakfast, and then kind of make these time capsules an opportunity throughout the course of this year, our 60th anniversary year, and then potentially culminate the 60th anniversary year with a creation of time capsules that we then bury in the ground in December of this year to culminate with our 60th anniversary of incorporation. So unless there's some strong desire to do something different, I think the city manager and I are working towards that thought process as a way to kind of connect 1994 and all of the people that have been in the community since then through now, and then expand it through 25 years from now when they can do this all over again. So
I like that idea. Definitely, okay. Particularly bringing the people from the past.
Correct.
Involve them as well.
Yes. Yes. So I think that's an item that we can do to connect our generations, connect the people that have helped found the city, and continue to just love and live in this city. So that's all I've got for tonight, unless there's any other discussion there. And we'll turn it over to the city manager for his comments.
Thank you. Just two really quick comments. The first is your city in action. We are embarking on a series of sidewalk repairs around the city on Grand Avenue, South 13th Street, near 16th Street Park, and Farrell Road to repair areas that are buckled and need to be smoother for pedestrian access. So you'll be seeing this work take place over the next few weeks, and just another example of the work we're doing to make our experience better for everybody in our community. And then we also have our next wayfinding sign that's been installed on North Oak Park Boulevard, southbound approaching Grand Avenue near the Burger King Nail Salon. There's a great blue turquoise sign directing people towards our beach, train station, businesses, and local parks. Just the third of our series of wayfinding signs that are popping up all across the city. And again, thanks to our maintenance crew for their work in getting these signs fabricated, up and installed, and more to come here very soon.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for that. City Attorney, any comments or reports this evening? Very good. And with that, unless there's anything else, we have no closed session items this evening, so I won't ask you for closed session announcements. But with that, we are adjourned. Yeah.